Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff. This week, a day late because of the Memorial Day holiday.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
No other podcast that comes out on Monday was coming out on Monday, so yeah. I'm fine with that. And so we will be talking about a whole host of topics. This is kind of going to be a grab bag episode. Our two main things, like in terms of sort of spoiler-ish territory, though I don't think either of these things are really affected by spoilers.
Yeah.
X-Men Apocalypse, which is newer. I think we'll probably talk about that first. So obviously a new movie came out this weekend. I really liked it. Like, I don't think it's a great movie, but I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would, and you didn't.
No, I think it's not a horrible movie. I think it's a pretty dull movie overall.
Okay. So you don't, I just wanted to get this out of the way. So you don't have like active like hate for it or anything. You don't.
No, although it is, I think it's really disappointing that like the X-Men movies felt like they're kind of coming around on something, and then this dropped. It was like, oh shit, this is like we are back to what you were making with like X-Men 3.
It's like, oh, and I don't think regressed. That at all.
Like, it's not as bad as X-Men 3, but it's regressed back towards that direction that the franchise used to be in.
I guess I'll just give my quick spoiler-free response to this movie. If you guys want to skip that segment later. Is, and maybe you can do your quick response too. I didn't think that. I think it is probably the weakest of this second wave of X-Men movies, but I still really like this cast they have in place. I really liked the new people they added. I think there's some really good casting in redoing some of the characters they've messed up the first time around.
Yeah.
I think the story is, it basically the whole movie feels like a long first act to like a bigger story, and then it ends kind of abruptly, and I don't normally like that. I like to find here, I think this is a movie that is much less than the sum of its parts, but those individual parts, I liked an awful lot of them. Like, there's a stretch with Magneto earlier in the movie that I really liked, where if you cut those scenes together as like a short film, I think it's a really good Magneto short film, and I think Michael Fassbender is really good in those scenes, and there's just things like that I liked about it. So I don't know. I went in with low expectations, and I had a good time. And I don't. We'll get into individual things later, but that was my response.
Yeah, I also went in with low expectations, but you had texted me saying, like, I think, like, as I looked at the text message after I came out of the movie, to be sure, this is what you said, where you said, to your credit, you said, it's not a perfect movie, but I really liked it. You should see it. So I was like, okay, I'll go see it. And I saw it. So that, like, out of, like, my fairly low expectations about the movie, there was, like, this glimmer of hope, and then I would say probably like 30 or 40 minutes into the movie, I like realized, oh, like, because I agree with you. There are parts of the movie and components of the movie, like with the Magneto section at the beginning, that are good individually. I think the movie just has no sense of identity or what it wants to be. That it doesn't have any idea what characters it wants to focus on. It like just manufactures character stuff for people to just like give them character moments over the course of the plot without ever feeling like characters earn moments or that a character develops or anything like that. And it feels like it retreads a huge amount of the same ground for characters like Magneto and Mystique that we have already covered through the past two movies multiple times in each movie, that like they're just kind of doing the same stuff. And then also with some of the returning characters with that are new cast members because they're younger now, we're even retreading some of the same ground with those characters from, like, 2007.
This will be the most interesting part of our discussion. Continuity-wise and, like, franchise placement-wise, I think this is a fascinating film.
Yeah.
Because, if nothing else, it does, I think, feel more transitionary than anything. Like, this is a bit of franchise management. Not in the way of, like, an Amazing Spider-Man 2 where it's just a bunch of trailers for other movies. But, like, we've got to tell a story, but we've also got to keep things in motion and introduce some new things so that there's room for this thing to grow. But I'm also wondering how exactly it grows with certain parts of this, and we'll get into that. But yeah. I think I generally have a higher tolerance for X-Men movies than you do. So
I mean, yeah. I mean, most of them are pretty dismal films. We've got three decent ones. We've got First Class, which is pretty good. We've got Days of Future Past, which is also fairly good. We've got Wolverine, which is kick-ass for most of it, but has a bad ending. And those are the three good X-Men movies.
And Deadpool? And you've got
Deadpool's a totally different thing. You have to admit, Deadpool does
it's
not.
It's part of the franchise. It's an X-Men movie. I think it's very different, but it
so does not fit in with any of the other movies at all. Like
okay.
Their version of the X-Men in that movie does not gel with the X-Men in any of the other movies.
Okay. Although I would imagine going forward, I think they're going to be playing by the Deadpool playbook way more than the Bryan Singer playbook. And you're forgetting about X2, which is a really good movie.
Was a good movie for its time.
No, I would say I watched it like last year, and I think it's still very good.
I watched it like 8 months ago.
Okay. I totally think that about the first X-Men movie, which is really bad if you watch it now. I like X2 just fine. It's a good movie.
But it's okay, but I think like it was pretty good for its time. I do not think it aged well.
Okay. Well, anyway, see, this is what I mean. I have a higher tolerance for this than you do, but whatever. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on. Clearly, we have a lot to talk about with X-Men Apocalypse. This is interesting. So we're going to do a couple of just little news pieces and pieces of stuff that I've kind of... I'm actually, one of these is a holdover from last week that we didn't get to, but I thought it would be fun to go over. Let's start. First piece of news.
Okay.
No Man's Sky.
Yes.
Was delayed.
It was. To August.
And somehow that got really controversial really fast in a way that video game delays never are.
Happened? Was it Jason Schreier at Kotaku that...
It was either him or Stephen.
It was one of the writers at Kotaku.
Yeah.
Not leaked it, but like reported on...
Broke the story.
Yeah, broke the story of like... But like presented it as like rumors, like not necessarily like 100% this is happening, but like sources indicate that this is going to happen, and because No Man's Sky is a really highly anticipated game and has been for a long time now, for several years, people who like video games tend to get riled up about some stuff on the internet. They got riled up because it's like, no, you're wrong, because I just want to play this game so it's not getting delayed. You're wrong. And then it was like 2 days later, this news came out. It's like, yeah, no, it's getting delayed by like 2 months. Fucking deal. And then everyone
June to August.
And then people sent death threats because people send death threats whenever something ever happens on the internet. But yeah, it was like a weird... it felt like it is one of the biggest overreactions to something that was just so nothing. In a community and like in a structure of society we have now where everything overreacts to everything constantly.
It's just weird because I didn't know No Man's Sky had that kind of following for a game that doesn't exist yet, and
it makes sense to me why people, especially because like if you think of it as like, well, a lot of these are probably like 14-year-old kids and stuff like that. Like they're like that game promises, to use a bad pun, it promises the sky. You know, it promises everything. It's like, oh, it's this like procedurally generated entire galaxy that you get to explore and all this stuff. And the way they have marketed that game is so effectively. I think it points to this reaction, how effective their marketing and the messaging around that game has been, that I think people have a very personal attachment to what they want this game to be, and they always have. It's like No Man's Sky has been a weird flashpoint for people's feelings about that kind of game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
okay.
It's news that I think normally we would like almost not even comment on, but you are right that there was like a day there when the news dropped officially. That it was just like, why is everyone reacting like this? Like
that's the only reason I threw it on the outline, because I mean, again, it's a June to August delay. It's nothing.
It's
frankly, I'm glad it's moving out of June because there's too much shit in June and I've got a backlog right now. And I was like, good. August, it's got to itself. There's nothing coming out in August. I can play, and then it's a big game, it'll have the month to itself. I'm perfectly fine with that. But,
games get delayed all the time. Like, they always have, they always will.
And they should.
Yeah.
Because, you know what? We've had a bunch of delayed games this year, like Uncharted 4 and Doom and stuff.
Yeah.
And you know what happened? They were super polished, and they're really good, and they've generally been the best games of this generation so far.
Yeah.
So, yes, games more than any other, like, this is something movies probably should do more.
Yeah.
Like, maybe, you know, X-Men Apocalypse, for instance, if they had taken another year on the script or something. Because everything else, the acting and the directing, that's fine. It's more, you know, when you set a date for something and then you go whole hog for it, sometimes you get a really compromised product.
Yeah.
And we saw that a lot at the beginning of this game generation, and now people are settled into it. We're getting better stuff. So delays are generally a good thing.
Yeah, I can understand why people would be disappointed if there's a game you're very excited about that gets delayed. I get that feeling for sure. I've been there when I was younger, but like you have to just realize, hey, it's a game. It's not that big a deal, and you want the game to come out in the best possible form, and you'll find something else to do in June.
I get that. I don't get the death threats and the...
Oh, well, no. I've never gotten that stuff. Like, that's just crazy people being crazy people. That's a totally different conversation.
There's a lot of crazy people out there. And there seems like there's more every day.
Well, I don't know if there's actually... Like, there are a lot, but in the scope of 7 billion people on the planet, there's not that many.
True. Okay.
Levelheads prevail, Jonathan.
This country's about to elect Donald Trump as president, Sean.
That's not going to happen.
Okay. I hope so, too. I don't think so, either. But this grand unified theory of humanity in which we're not crazy might not be true.
But if we're all crazy, that means that crazy isn't crazy, Jonathan.
That's sad.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on.
More on that later.
More on that later. Okay, quick piece of stuff from me.
All right.
Like, just, because, okay, what we've been doing, I mean, I've been playing Doom. What have you been up to? Just doing stuff?
Doing stuff, yeah. Because I finished Doom, like, because I sort of plodded along. And I mean, I platinumed it, so I did everything.
Oh, holy shit.
Yeah. So, that's, yeah, I guess I have been playing a lot of Doom as
so,
well.
So, okay, tell me about the platinum trophy. Is that, like, a possible thing to do with Doom?
Yes, it's very, like, I would not have gone for it if it wasn't, like, I don't, what difficulty are you playing on? Is it like just the default?
I started on Ultraviolence because you recommended that.
That's how I started.
This most recent level, I had to switch.
Okay, to Hurt Me Plenty, which I think is the default. Yeah, so I don't know if there's a separate trophy for beating it on Ultraviolence or not, but if you beat it on Ultraviolence, you do not have to play through the whole game on a harder difficulty because there's two harder ones. Yeah. You have to beat the first level on Ultra Nightmare, which basically removes checkpoints and is like really hard. But, like, you could beat the first level, that's fine. And it's mostly just, like, playing through the game and getting all the secrets gets you, like, 95% of the trophies.
Okay, and so there's not, like, a giant multiplayer suite of trophies.
No, you have to get, like, level 5 in multiplayer, I think. That could be fun.
Yeah.
And you have to make a snap map and do all the snap map tutorials, which takes, like, 5 minutes.
Okay, I will probably go for this, too, because I'm definitely... I mean, I don't forget if I said this at the top of the show. Our other topic this week is Doom, because it's great.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about it. I've been playing that. I can't wait to go back and do some of the secrets because I'm like, I'm too into it to like stop and go exploring right now, but it's like Halo. I'm fine going back and like, you know, Halo being the skulls or something. Just getting to know those levels because they're so good. We'll get into that. Anyway, the other thing I've been playing though, out of the blue, so I just want to tell this story because it's kind of funny. I got a hankering to play an old Pokemon game.
Okay.
Because, you know, they put Red, Blue, Yellow out on the 3DS earlier this year and those emulations were so disappointing. And even though I like those games, it's just, it was hard to go back to them in that form.
Sure.
But I really love Gold and Silver.
Yes.
I've not gone back and played those. In a long time. And I got my Crystal cartridge out. So Crystal, if you don't know, is the third version of Gold and Silver. It's like a director's cut one where they add a bunch of stuff in. And actually, Crystal added a ton in terms of like usability that became the norm for Pokemon. It probably is like the biggest, has a lot of the biggest shifts that series ever had. Anyway, so I got my Pokemon Crystal cartridge out, put in my Game Boy Advance SP, and the battery's dead.
Yep.
So, like, I can save, but the time system is off. And if you don't have the... In those games, you have a time... Like, it's synced the time in the real world.
Yeah, so, like, if it's at night, you have to... If you want, like, specific night Pokemon, you have to play the game at night, or you have to cheese the clock.
You have to cheese the clock. So, the problem was, the clock wouldn't advance, so I started it at night, so I could only play it at night. And that just wouldn't be a fun experience.
Yeah.
So... I usually shy away from emulators because in my experience they've just been more hassle than I'm interested in putting into it.
Sure.
Which I know, and people have different tolerance levels for PC stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And I totally get, I am on the low tolerance side. Well, I was really lucky. There was recently released for the Mac a new emulation software that is fucking awesome. It's called OpenEMU. And it's just, I can even open it here if you want to see it, but it basically just is a shell for a bunch of emulation softwares.
Okay, yeah.
And I've even narrowed down the list, but it's got like the Atari systems, the Japanese versions of like the Famicom and the Super Famicom, all the Game Boys, and NES, Super NES, DS, all the Sega systems, all that stuff. Basically, the most complex being N64. So up to like that level, like PlayStation 1, N64, it's got everything in there. You just drag your ROMs in there, and they can be ones made for like PC, so like that come in an EXE file, which Mac could not normally read. And it just does all of it, and it's super fluid. It's completely integrated with the latest version of Mac OS, so you can go full screen, all of that stuff. Really easily. It's like, it's what I've always wanted out of an emulation software. And it's always been more of a hassle than that. And it's just right there. It's this shell for everything. It is super easy. I don't have to think about it. And it's awesome. And like games look really, really nice, like the Game Boy Color games. So I've been playing Pokemon Crystal.
Nice.
And I got into it. And I've been having fun. I've put like 25 hours in at this point.
Jeez.
I really got into it. And
What starter did you pick?
Chikorita.
Okay.
I like Chikorita. But I've been playing in such a way where I've been using a lot of different Pokemon, where I basically just cycle through every time someone levels up. So my whole team is in the 40s right now. But it's been a lot of fun. I love those games. I would make the argument those are the best Pokemon games on a number of levels.
You can make the argument.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be wrong.
Okay.
But you can make the argument.
Okay. Anyway, but I just think those games, they have... I've got a lot of notes, and I might, when I'm done with this whole project... do a little article for the site on this.
Sure.
Remembering Pokemon Crystal, now that we're in the 20th anniversary of Pokemon. Might be apropos to do that. But anyway, there's just a bunch of cool stuff that those games do. Like, it's got a weirdly dark tone, is one of the things I love about those games. Like, because in the first few hours, you have stuff like the Unknown Cave, which is like this super weird, like, mystical crap that goes on with the unknowns. And you've got the town you get to that is usually full of slowpokes, but they're all gone because Team Rocket stole them and is cutting off their tails for the black market. You just got shit like that when you get to Goldenrod City, which is like the big megalopolis they have, you know, here. Metropolis you have here. They, like, you can go underground and there's people basically selling drugs. They don't call it that, but it's like stuff you can buy that would have no positive use and is inflated in price.
You gotta smoke that slowpoke tail, brother.
It's really interesting, the tone in that game. And I love, like, the whole Johto region is based on areas in Japan that, while I've never been to Japan, seeing pictures and movies, I really love, you know, where there's lots of trees and foliage and it's, and shrines and temples. There's just shrines throughout. Like, it's a very weirdly, like, religious game in how much you just get into the religion of Pokemon. And, like, the legendary you get in Crystal at least is Suicune, who comes to the tower because you have attained this level of enlightenment. Like, it's it's really interesting, all that stuff. So I really like that. It's got such a great mix of Pokemon because you've got all the original ones, plus the Johto Pokemon, who are definitely the second coolest.
Yes, it is the second best set of Pokemon.
Absolutely. And put them all together, it's nice, because you get that extra variety.
Sure,
so, it's just, it's a really fun game. I've been having fun with that. Just playing on an emulator that makes it so easy to do that, and I don't have to worry about that. And definitely moving forward, like, because I've also tried some other Game Boy games in there. If I'm ever going back to play a Game Boy game, I'm going to do it on this emulator because they run so well. It has the color features. If you have, like, an original Game Boy game and you put in a Game Boy Color, you know, you could run it in color in different palettes. It's got all that.
Nice.
And, like, the 3DS doesn't have any of that. And that's really disappointing, I think. So, you know, I own all these games legally. I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. I know it's technically illegal, but whatever.
Stupid law. It's like technically illegal in, like, the most sort of offhand way, in that there's no law that is actually designed to to discuss software emulation in that way at all.
Yeah.
So,
like, I don't, you know, like, emulating a game I would never pay for or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, which is just called piracy, you know? But if it's a, especially because Nintendo's not making money on Pokemon Crystal anymore. It's that kind of stuff, too.
Yeah.
Like, if you, you know, I also got some of the original, like, Final Fantasies on there because I just want to see them that way. Like, it's really crazy. Final Fantasy 1 on the original NES version of that game is a head trip if you've only played, like, the GBA version. It's hilarious. Again, Square is making no money on that.
Not on the original NES version. They are not selling NES cartridges of Final Fantasy anymore.
Anyway, so that's my moral stance on emulation. But piracy bad, emulation is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it's been fun. I even got a little USB controller for my computer that's like an SNES controller.
Nice.
So you can get those for cheap, and that's fun. And, you know, SNES controllers are cool.
Sure.
For those kind of games. You can't play Doom with them, but...
No.
Well, you can play Doom on the Super NES, but you wouldn't want to do that.
No. You definitely would not want to do that.
Anyway, all right, so that's that. Just want to talk about that because I was having so much fun with Pokemon Crystal, although I've been a little sidetracked by Doom because there are not two gaming experiences more different than a old Pokemon game, which is, like, relaxing, it's, like, fun.
Yeah.
I said this one has kind of a darker tone, but it's primarily lighthearted.
Yeah, it's still a kid's game.
Yeah, and then Doom, which kids should not play Doom.
No. Well, I mean,
some, like, 15, it's the perfect age, but
sure, yeah, I would say 13 is actually, that's, like, really the perfect age when, like, ripping open a demon's skull is the maximum amount of possible cool.
All right, so that's all the stuff I've got. Do you have anything else?
Not really. As I said, I've been mostly messing around with Doom, some Witcher stuff. I'm almost done with the most recent Witcher book, so I'm basically caught up.
And then you have the long wait for the...
The year-long wait or whatever, how long it's going to be for them to translate the last one.
Are those still good?
Yes, yeah, they're very good books.
Awesome.
I recommend them for people who like the games.
I haven't had a lot of time to read lately, but if I get into it, maybe I'll... I would like to read those too, and then we can do a Witcher book discussion.
We can do a...
The Weekly Stuff Book Club.
Yes, the long-awaited feature that we've never thought of until this very second.
Yes. Well, we talked about The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings once. But that's...
We did once,
So that's book-related. We talked about how both of us tried to read The Silmarillion and couldn't. That kind of thing.
I am still, to this day, even though I have met people that have definitely read The Silmarillion, I don't think anyone has ever finished The Silmarillion. I don't even think it's possible. You, like, think you read the last page and you just hallucinated it.
Well, because it would put you to sleep and yeah. you would dream about reading it.
It can't be done. It is the book that cannot be read.
And we say this with all love to J.R.R.
Yeah,
Tolkien.
No.
But there might have been a reason why he never published it in his lifetime.
Exactly.
That's all. All right. So let's go ahead. I do want to do one piece of, I guess, current events news, just because so little is going on.
Yeah.
But it's fun to do this kind of thing. I want to do a check-in on the DC Comics movies.
Okay,
and,
right, yeah.
Because a lot of stuff has happened.
Yeah, lots of little things have happened, and it felt like there's nothing big enough each week that we had to comment on it.
But now there's a list. Let me go through over the month of May, here is what has happened at DC.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers, really, but the DC Films Division.
Exactly.
Okay. The writer and director of the Flash movie, Seth Graham Smith, who wrote and directed, like, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, I think.
Right.
He left over a creative dispute. He would be the second person to do that after Michelle MacLaren, Breaking Bad director, left on Wonder Woman over similar creative disputes when they would literally not give her enough money to make the movie.
Yeah, and that was before Batman v Superman.
That was before.
That shit happened.
So, of the, like, four movies they're making, like, half the directors have left.
Yeah.
All the non-Zack Snyder people have departed their movies except the guy who's doing Aquaman.
Yeah.
Who's James Wan. Who I would be shocked if James Wan gets to make his Aquaman movie the way he wants to make that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we'll see. Ben Affleck was promoted to executive producer on Justice League. This follows reports that he will be directing a Batman movie that has never been confirmed. People keep saying that's been confirmed. They've said they're going to make one. They have in no way said he will be creatively involved beyond a producer role.
Yeah.
But, so you should go back and actually look at the transcripts. People reported it as he's directing a Batman movie. That's not true. Mm-hmm. He could, but that will not make those bad reports any less bad.
And somehow everyone is absolutely 100% convinced that movie is going to be called The Batman. That
really?
Like everyone is like, whenever I see people talking about it online, it's Ben Affleck is directing The Batman in italics. It's like,
no,
that's the name of that cartoon from like 2004. I don't think they're going to call that movie Batman.
They're going to call it Batman, the Brave and the Bold and go in a totally different direction.
Exactly, yes. They're going to just like do the Adam West style Batman that we all have always wanted them to do all along. And it's going to be great and fix everything.
Anyway, so he was promoted to executive producer on Justice League. Sort of, this will come into play with later stuff. Charles Roven, who is the producer on the Zack Snyder movies, on the upcoming DC movies, was removed from his active producer role on DC. He will be involved in Justice League because it's already shooting. He was basically kicked off of Aquaman and The Flash and will be reassigned to some kind of overall executive producer role. So his name will be on these, but he's off the movies.
Yeah.
He would have been one of the driving creative forces on these up to now. Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, etc. Biggest news probably is John Berg, who is the producer on Ben Affleck's films, like The Town and Argo and those things. He and Jeff Johns, who DC people will know because he works for the comics.
Yeah.
He has executive produced and like helped produce the DC TV shows right now that everyone likes. And he's currently running their new Rebirth series.
Yeah.
He and this guy, John Berg, will be running DC Films. They'll be overseeing what they are calling the DC Films Division. Remember, up until this announcement, there was no DC Films Division. There was no overhead management. It was really just Zack Snyder and Charles Roven and Deborah Snyder producing these movies. And finally, what made me want to talk about it this week is that Jeremy Irons gave an interview to the Daily Mail, I believe. I'm going to read you a paragraph, an excerpt from this interview.
Yeah, go ahead. Right. I've read it, but...
Yeah. Really, ambition has gone, Irons insists. I look for things that tickle my fancy. You begin to see the end of life on the horizon. You think, it's not going on forever, this. Let's make the most of what time I have left. That gives him the freedom to be entertainingly frank, starting with his most recent film, Batman v Superman, in which he played the loyal British butler Alfred. It was popular at the box office, but got an absolute kicking from critics. Says Irons, deservedly so. I mean, it took in $800 million, so the kicking didn't matter, but it was sort of overstuffed. He let those words hang in the air. Sorry.
Then he coughed profusely.
He might have. Then laughs at the thought of a film described by one critic as the most incoherent blockbuster in years. It was very muddled, he says. I think the next one will be simpler. The script is certainly not smaller. It's more linear. There's no getting out of it now. I'm tied into the Batman at the minute. The next installment is due next year, which is nice because it's a bit of income. So that's Jeremy Irons, star of Batman v Superman.
Facing his own mortality and his role in these movies.
So, Sean, can we call it a dumpster fire yet?
I mean, it is... It's something that I think we all anticipated after Batman v Superman dropped, let's call it. and like, we knew that obviously for like the weeks following while it was still in theaters and it was still like bringing in money, that Warner Brothers was not going to say anything to try to sabotage the movie's success. But I think everyone knew that the audience and critical reception to it was so astoundingly negative that, I mean, the production studio has to respond to that kind of feedback. And it's just like, and you just see that this like slow, like dissolution of everything, of all the plans that they set in motion, like the great hubris that they had expressed a year or two ago when they said, we're not making Man of Steel 2, we're making Batman v Superman, we're making Flash, we're making Aquaman, we're making 5 billion Justice League movies, we're making Wonder Woman, we're making all of these movies off of Man of Steel, which was one of the most like critically divisive movies of its year. We're going to just like, based off of that platform, we're going to start this whole fucking thing. And then the next movie, at the very next movie, the second fucking movie in their DC cinematic universe, all those plans seem to be dissolving apart and they have to like restructure everything and reconsider what they're doing. And I bet they are really, really mad that they decided to do Justice League so soon off of, and like get it like well into pre-production before Batman v Superman even dropped, to the point where they can't like reasonably back out of it. Because Batman v Superman had come out and they had like a year more of like time of like not really that deep into Justice League, I think they probably would have pushed that movie back or canceled it outright.
I think they absolutely would have, and that is a huge issue. They pushed it into production and announced that start date before Batman v Superman came out, and most would say it was probably to assure shareholders, because the buzz around that movie, even before it dropped, was so bad.
Yeah.
And it was, the reports were leaking that everyone in Warner Brothers knew it was bad. This is not one of those scenarios where, like, people were confident in the movie.
Right,
and then it came, like, Fox was actually very confident in X-Men Apocalypse. And we'll talk about that later, because they dropped that for critics a month ago.
Yeah.
Which was kind of, and I do kind of get it, because I think that movie, I can understand how a studio would look at that and say that's okay.
Sure,
It is not a dumpster fire or anything.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So, but that's not what we're in here. Everyone knew it was bad, and they did that to kind of just shore up, like, no, we're confident, see? And it was, it's all the bottom line. There's no creative thinking going on here, although maybe they're trying to do that now.
Yeah.
But it just shows there's a lot of problems here. Now, I don't know if Seth Graham Smith was the right guy for The Flash. Does not sound like that to me at all, but that still means you have, again, this is your second director you've hired. Writer-director, basically, who's left the project over creative differences, which never means anything good.
Yeah.
No one ever leaves happily over creative differences. So you've got that going on. And then you also have to look at, so these are the official reports I outlined. But where there's smoke, there's fire. And some of this is smoke for larger fires, which is the amount of involvement Ben Affleck and his team are getting on these movies. There have been reports, and this was before Batman v Superman dropped, and since, and this is unconfirmed, but I think this kind of confirms it. Ben Affleck was really unhappy shooting Batman v Superman. He was not having a good time.
I mean, he was so bummed after Batman v Superman that he became a temporary internet meme in that one interview with, like, sad Ben Affleck.
Yeah, and I think he has put a lot of his chips with Warner Brothers, and they've put a lot of their chips with him, and they need to make this guy happy. He won them a boatload of Oscars like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He agreed to be in their big bomb of a movie. I guess it didn't technically bomb, but we'll talk about that. You know, all this shit. And it's like they're not holding up their end of the deal. So really what they're doing is like, no, Ben Affleck, you come on and be more creatively involved. Which from a creative standpoint, I think Ben Affleck is a talented guy and he's a talented writer and director. He's not a comic guy.
Yeah.
I don't see how that solves any of the problems. I don't see... I do kind of see the Geoff Johns thing.
Sure.
But the problem with Geoff Johns... I think Geoff Johns is a tremendously talented person. The problem with Geoff Johns is that he's not, like, leaving any of his other jobs.
Yeah.
He is still overseeing a bunch of the comics. He's still helping to oversee a bunch of those TV shows. Maybe he can help kind of open up the tonal direction of these movies. But basically, they need a Kevin Feige. Like, what Marvel has. Kevin Feige was a guy who worked with Marvel Comics, who devoted himself to the movies, and is the active day-to-day producer on every single one of them. And so that's why you have this overall sort of level of coherence and quality to those films, because it is a very producer-oriented structure over there at Marvel, which if you're going to do this kind of multi-movie experiment, you have to have.
Exactly, yeah.
They don't have that at DC, and I don't think adding someone who is stretched as thin as Geoff Johns is, and then Ben Affleck and his people, will really solve that.
Yeah, because also, like, I mean, Geoff Johns is a talented comic book writer, but he's not, like, a writing god. Like, it's not like... I mean, he's good, But, like, and he's been in DC for a while. But also, DC's comic stuff is kind of also a dumpster fire right now.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't talk about comic book stuff that much because I kind of got out of reading comics a while ago. But, like, I do kind of keep up with it. And the stuff, the fucking stuff that they're doing right now with where they, like, 5 years ago, they started the New 52 thing, and we talked about it on, like, a different incarnation of this podcast then, because that's when I kind of started getting back into reading comics a little bit more regularly, where they basically restarted the continuity of their comics universe and did this whole New 52 thing, where it's, like, 52 different, like, new comic book runs, like, with different characters and stuff, and some of them, like, the Batman and Wonder Woman runs from back then are great, and I kept up with them for a while. A lot of it was just kind of weird, and it felt like they didn't know what they were doing for their new overall universe. And now, with the DC Rebirth thing, they are basically bringing back the pre-New 52 continuity and having that come into the New 52 continuity and basically take over the New 52 continuity. And, like, a week ago, New 52 Superman fucking died. They just kill, and nobody even knows that New 52 Superman died, because nobody gives a shit about what's happening in comic books anymore.
I mean, the only thing I've even heard is on the Marvel side, the big Captain America.
Yeah, the Captain America thing dropped, which is also really phenomenally stupid, but that's a different conversation. But yeah, like the DC comic stuff is also in a bad place. And all the, like, comic book movies and superhero movie stuff that's going on right now is just making me reflect on how poorly both DC and Marvel have been, like, trying to coordinate their cinematic success to reflect back onto the comic books and capitalize on that in any way. And they're, and, like, reintroducing your 30, 40 plus year continuity that you had in, like, the post-crisis stuff for DC and bringing that back into the New 52 as some way to solve, like, your old fans' issues with the New 52 continuity is not a way to bring in new readers. It's like they're fucking that up on the comic book side so bad also that makes, like, them fucking it up this bad on the movie side just, like, what are you guys doing? Like, how is this even possible?
How hard is it to just tell a story with these characters?
Apparently really fucking hard, because, man, I've put God knows how many hours into my life of trying to understand comic book continuity, and I feel like with this DC Rebirth stuff, on top of all the weird stuff that they did with rebooting the universe, but, like, kind of half-rebooting it with New 52, it's like, I have no idea what fucking is happening anymore. I don't want to read their comics to try to figure it out, because they're all bad.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Well, anyway, just the Jeremy Irons thing is the funniest thing here.
Yeah.
But it is funny how they have not been able to keep a lid on discontent within the people who worked on that movie.
Yeah.
They've not been able to keep a lid on, you know, people leaving angrily from their films. I mean, if you remember, it was sort of hush-hush, but Michelle McLaren's exit from Wonder Woman was ugly.
Yes.
And frankly, pretty sexist on their part,
yeah,
in how they were treating her and stuff like that. And so it's just, I don't see how anyone could be excited for this stuff right now. This is a ship that is on fire with holes in it, and they basically hired a new captain to try to get people to take the buckets and throw the water out faster.
And Zack Snyder's just riding it down, laughing like a fucking maniac all the way.
I mean, that's the thing. I really do think, because apparently there's just been a lot of, with this Justice League movie, they are trying, like, on the fly to, while they're shooting it, augment it and change it and try to get it better. Because it's very clearly, it's a sequel to Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
And if it comes out and it's anywhere near the reaction of that movie, that's it. The nail in the coffin. You can't come back from that. That's their last chance.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Wonder Woman will be good and will engender some enthusiasm, but it's not going to be a hit on the scale they need, you know? So we'll see. Dumpster fire. That's all there is to it.
Also, saying that Zack Snyder's name reminded me of the other thing that is happening with the DC Rebirth stuff that is also phenomenally stupid. So this is what has happened in comic books in, like, I swear, the past 2 or 3 weeks, and this is me just sort of, like, casually trying to keep up with this generally going on, is New 52 Superman died. Nobody knew about it. Captain America is apparently working for Hydra, and it became a meme before that comic book even launched, because that twist and that panel got leaked out.
I do like the meme.
Yeah, the meme's pretty funny. But then also, and I feel like, as far as I understand, this has not been 100%, like, seen and confirmed as the final twist for how the continuity stuff is happening in DC Rebirth, but the strong implication and symbolism in at the end of the DC Rebirth number one suggests that the figure, the shadowy figure that has been doing this all along since the beginning of New 52, that's been fucking with the parallel universes, is Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen. They are bringing Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen into the DC universe when that is not what they've like the Watchmen universe is technically one of their like multiverse worlds, but it's never interacted with anything else because DC before had never been so stupid to do that. But considering a couple of years ago they did their like before Watchmen like spin-off anthology series with all these different comic book creators that nobody wanted them to do, nobody really liked them, nobody gave a shit about them, and now Dr. Manhattan haven't shown him in a panel, but I looked at transcripts and scans of the last couple of pages of DC Rebirth number one, and it's pretty fucking clear that it's supposed to be Dr. Manhattan.
So they're at least killing Alan Moore symbolically, and they might actually kill him. Like he might just reverberate.
He's an immortal eldritch spirit. Like I'm pretty sure he's several thousand years old. I think he like his original form was like as an oak tree or something, and he left his body and like grew a human form at some point. That's what Alan Moore is. Yeah, but DC's trying their best to try to kill him and like everything about him, and just trying to destroy the American comic book industry wholesale. I don't know, but comic books are really dumb. But they should be dumb. And it's really hard to try to be a fan of comic books in any way when like the past 2 weeks have been pretty fucking rough in that regard.
Yeah, it's amazing because these Marvel and DC things happened at the same time.
Yeah,
and it just, to someone who does not read comic books, it seems so desperate and petty, all of it.
Yeah, it's just, as someone who does read comic books, it's utterly incomprehensible. I just don't know why, when the superhero movies are so popular, why you wouldn't scale back in comic books and like make it way more approachable for new readers. And instead, they've just leaned way harder into the worst, most excessive storytelling trends that comic books have had since like the 90s. But yeah, that's our brief comic book check-in, because I feel like that has to be addressed.
X-Men Apocalypse stuff is better than that shit. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's...
it's not offensive. It's okay. I mean,
the continuity is almost as confusing, but it makes a little bit more sense.
Except, okay, well, we'll transition to our X-Men Apocalypse discussion.
Yeah.
Spoilers from here on out. After that, we're going to talk about Doom. I really don't think either of these can be spoiled in a way that would impact your enjoyment one way or another. You know, it's not like... Apocalypse is not Civil War, where there's a big twist that alters the universe or anything.
Yeah.
It's an X-Men movie. They do X-Men stuff. You know, if you like that, you might like this. If not, who knows? But let's go ahead and talk about X-Men Apocalypse. I mean, I'm at a point, though, where I want to preface it with this. If the continuity stuff bothers you with the X-Men movies, I get it. I totally get it. I'm not trying to belittle that.
Yeah.
Because I get that that could just hurt part of your brain, because they've invited that by not just doing a reboot at some point. Which, it's weird that this is like the one franchise we're probably asking for a reboot on.
Yeah.
Or if they had just... like my brother, I went to see this with my brother, and he said, you could really justify it if they had just made it clear at the end of Days of Future Past that Wolverine had created split timelines.
Exactly.
That's all you, and maybe you just have to assume that. So I understand if that's a problem, and I do think going forward it's a question that they're going to have to figure out, because I think they have some really promising stuff in Apocalypse, but if they continue on the prequel route, they can't do that. Like, you can't do more with this Jean Grey if you assume the Famke Janssen Jean Grey happened.
Yeah.
You have to ignore... and I'm okay with
it. You already can't do what they already did with any of those characters.
I get it. But here's the thing. I find it kind of fun. And maybe it's just ironic. I laugh at the continuity stuff in these movies, because it's been silly for years. It made no sense in the original three, for God's sakes. And so you get to this point, and I just think there's fun things where you just kind of... it's like, okay, they did the Wolverine thing. I liked that scene and all. It now makes no sense how X-Men 1 could happen. But you know what? Let's just roll with it and have fun. And I know I'm not the only person who works in that mode. I've read some other reviews of people who kind of find it funny on that level. I find the ages in this movie hilarious. Yeah. That apparently 10 years passed and Quicksilver didn't leave his basement.
Yeah, like...
I love that. And I don't know. I just laugh at that stuff. It's not the most substantive part of the movie for me. But I get why it's probably problematic for some people.
I mean, for me, where it really... I think there's a couple of things. It's one, now that Bryan Singer has made the same number of X-Men movies in the new mold as in the old mold. There's something really weird where it's like the whole fucking Wolverine sequence, and we'll talk about that in more detail, but like where it's like visually clearly calling back to X2. Like they go like with like the snowy mountain, like
they go to the same place, yeah.
Wilderness. Like it's so trying to call back to that specifically. And when you're trying to do that, it's that. It's when you're trying to reference things that we're supposed to know from the first three movies in what should be its own new continuity. That's the part where it's just like, why? Just okay, stay the fuck away from it. Because that's the part where it's like, now as a moviegoer, like, I need to, like, you're inviting me to try to think about the continuity. You're inviting me to think about, like, well, how does this happen? Or when you're doing the Phoenix shit at the end with Jean Grey, which I will also talk about that more, because that's another one of my problems with the movie. As soon as you start referencing these things, which are that happened or were iconic elements of the first three X-Men movies in your new, semi-new continuity, that's where it, like, really kind of ticks me off.
I get it, and it's the weirdest thing about Apocalypse, because... So let's just retrace it for a little bit, really quick. So First Class is a prequel. It's a fairly direct prequel. It's got some things that don't add up, and I think that's fine. Plenty of prequels don't.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's like, okay, here's younger Xavier and Magneto. Their ages are correct. We don't get to have the actual First Class because they would be too young, so we have some new people. And that's probably the weakest part of that movie. Overall, though, that's a really good superhero movie. Yeah. It's got a lot of great stuff in it, and that's kind of fun. And so it's a prequel. Days of Future Past is a mix because it's still, you're setting the prequel, but Wolverine in the future goes back. And honestly, actually, the most confusing side of that continuity-wise is that it basically ignores The Last Stand ever happened.
Yeah.
Which I do kind of get because Bryan Singer didn't get to make that one. Yeah. And he was sticking it to Fox, who really fucked him back in the day. But anyway, so that kind of is confusing. But again, it kind of seemed like Days of Future Past, you could just perfectly at the end say, new timeline, and then we're done. And you never have to think about it again. The weird thing about Apocalypse, though, is that scene to scene, some scenes are clearly, this is a prequel. Yeah. And some scenes are, this is in no way a prequel.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just clearly sometimes the movie is not thinking about it, doesn't care. It's doing its own thing. And sometimes it's not. So I think the biggest thing is like, so you have like the Jean Grey stuff and the Jean Grey Professor X relationship in this with James McAvoy and Sophie Turner, who have some really nice moments together, I thought. Sure. But like, it's very clearly calling back to what we know about Patrick Stewart and the Famke Janssen character, and that this is the early days of their relationship, but at some point, you know, in the original movies, he fucking dies for her and that kind of thing. And it's clearly thinking about that, right?
Yes.
And so you have scenes like that. You have the Wolverine scene, which is officially decanonizing the X-Men Origins movie, by the way.
Yeah.
That has been fully, between that and Deadpool, that movie has been fully kicked out of the canon, which I love. Anyway, but so you have that scene, which is clearly, this is, you know, what led to stuff like X2.
Yeah.
So that's clearly a prequel scene. And that stuff does and doesn't add up in different ways, whatever. But then you have stuff like Nightcrawler in this movie.
Yeah, and Angel.
And I like their Nightcrawler just fine in this. I think he's fun, and I think he has good interactions with the cast. And I like that character a lot, as they did him in X2, where he was played by Alan Cumming. But in X2, they're meeting him for the first time. They don't know him, and he's been alone his whole life. And that's the whole character arc there. And so in that, you just assume the movie is ignoring that, because that there's no way those two things add up.
Yeah.
And so, scene to scene, I just kind of have fun with this, and I enjoy the scenes, but I do understand there is it goes back and forth whiplashy enough.
Yeah.
Like, if it was just a prequel with elements that were off, that would be one thing, or if it was just they're ignoring the continuity, that would be another thing, but it's half and half. Like, the most confusing thing is Mystique. Like, and she's honestly barely in this movie, like, compared to her, like, she was in First Class a lot, she was in Days of Future Past less, and then she's in, like, and Jennifer Lawrence in every scene here, and I love Jennifer Lawrence, and she's an awesome actress and person. She is so bored in this movie.
Yeah,
she looks like she wants to slit her wrists in every scene. I have not seen an actor this visibly bored in a major blockbuster in some time.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that character, like, by the end, they have gone as far away as they possibly could. And with some other characters, like with Professor X, they're very clearly setting up, okay, now he's Patrick Stewart. We get that. Yeah. Or like with Magneto, I don't know what they're doing with Magneto. But anyway.
They don't either, clearly.
They do in some parts of this movie, though, and that's but what they pisses
don't,
me off.
But like, it doesn't matter if they do in some parts, if they don't in the whole movie.
And that's the frustrating thing about this movie. I think there are, I liked almost all the individual parts in this movie a lot, and it does not add up in the end. And there's some very weird things in the end where just on a basic script writing level, I thought I knew exactly where they were going with it, and then they didn't go there. But anyway, we'll get into that. So anyway, like I was saying, continuity-wise, you have stuff like Mystique and Nightcrawler. They are a different Mystique and Nightcrawler than we knew.
Yeah.
But this is ostensibly the same Professor X, Magneto, and Jean Grey, and Cyclops, you know? So, that kind of stuff, yeah. I understand if it bothers you, and that's a valid response, yeah. because it's there, and it is inviting that.
But, and it's not only that, it's also, I think, specifically, there's stuff, there's design, there's, like, so much stuff of, like, the theme of the movie that, like, they do with, like, the X-Men theme from the old movies that, like, is remind... There's so much set design stuff that's reminding you constantly of, like, it's the old basement and all that stuff. It's, like, the Cerebro. Like, all that, like, element of how that stuff looks is the same as the original X-Men movie. I don't remember if First Class had that stuff as well. But, like...
They had the same mansion. They hadn't built Cerebro yet.
Yeah, because it's, like, it's those, like, stark, like, stainless steel hallways and stuff underneath the mansion and all that element of the design of the movie... And so it's like all of that stuff that I feel like they should just move past that because I think it looks bad and outdated. Like it looks so much like something that's set from a movie in 2000 that's trying to look cool, like Matrix-y, that it's like does not look good now. Like they should go with a different aesthetic by now. But like if you're trying to tie into the future movies or the past movies that are the future movies, then you have to have it look like that basically. But then also they're doing stuff where it's like this movie, unlike Days of Future Past, is like calling back to X-Men First Class in really like specific ways that like I had completely forgotten that Moira MacTaggert was a character in X-Men First Class. And she's not like a major character here, but she's in like among the hero characters for most of the movie. And then bringing back Havoc and killing Havoc from X-Men First Class like reminded me of like, oh right. He was in X-Men First Class, and that might be the same actor. I don't even know.
It was.
I did not remember anything about Havoc from the first movie other than that, oh, right, they did him instead of doing Cyclops. And so it's stuff like that of where you're like bringing back characters I had forgotten about in First Class and having them mix with stuff where like apparently like and at the end of X-Men Apocalypse... The whole, like, it feels like they're trying to set up, well, this is how the X-Men happen, finally, really, for reals this time, with the whole, like, they're in the danger room, and Mystique is leading them, apparently, now, and the robot, the Sentinel-looking robot guys come out, and the X-Men door closes on bald James McAvoy as Professor X. That's, like, is, like, mimicking, like, a very sort of, like, iconic shot from the original X-Men. Like, all that stuff is like, what are you doing? Like, how are you trying to, like, use this movie somehow as a pivot point? But then also, they're probably going to make more X-Men movies that are set past this point that are not just... Like all that stuff is... Like, it seems insane that you would do it that way. That, like, if they dialed it back more, I wouldn't care that much. Like, I didn't really care that much about, like, the continuity hiccups in Days of Future Past. It was just sort of, like, whatever to me, and I could, like... poke fun at them as like a fake criticism, but wasn't a big deal. Here, I think it's extremely distracting in the movie because it's my main issue with the movie, and this is one element of that, is that the movie feels like it has no idea what it wants to be. Does it want to be like First Class, or does it want to be like the next X-Men movies? Does it want to feel like it is a pivot point for those two things? Because for most of the movie, it didn't feel like that. And then the last like scene of the movie feels 100% like the movie where it's like, oh, this is the movie where Professor X learned why the X-Men are necessary, felt like how the movie ended, but nothing for the rest of the movie felt like it was really arguing about that at all.
They pay lip service to it. I mean, it's
they
one of the
They pay least... lip service to it, but it's for that the... to be the ending
no, I
moment
get it.
For your film.
And this is my biggest complaint with the movie, too, because it affects a lot of the things I did like, and I really do, I think we all assumed when we saw Days of Future Past, that was them saying goodbye to the old continuity. We were going to just forge ahead from now on and not worry about that. And I think everyone would have been happy. I think it was and I love that movie for a lot of reasons. I think the main thing is it's this really nice intersection point of my nostalgia for those original new movies.
Sure, yeah.
What I really like about this new era and just kind of passing the torch. And it works really well in that way. Almost like something like, and obviously this is very different, but like Skyfall for James Bond.
Sure, yeah.
Where Skyfall is sort of Bond becoming Sean Connery Bond.
Yeah.
And they don't do it in the same way. Like, he doesn't meet Sean Connery. Although he was going to
in
the original
script.
He should
have, goddammit.
I mean, they couldn't get him to do the part, but that old guy at the end of Skyfall was scripted to be Sean Connery.
Yeah.
And then they got Albert Finney, who is just fine.
Yeah.
Albert Finney is not equally awesome, maybe, but he is a good choice. Anyway,
yeah.
So Skyfall is kind of that same thing. But it is interesting to me. Skyfall, I think, and Days of Future Past came out around the same time. I might be off on that. But both those, that... So Spectre, which is the sequel to Skyfall, and this, which is the sequel... to Days of Future Past. Don't seem to fully understand what the previous movies did, even though they're made by the exact same people. And that is weird to me, because there are parts, and Apocalypse is even weirder, because there are full-on parts of Apocalypse where it feels like they are just saying, we're going to forge ahead, and we're going to have our new Cyclops, and we're going to have our new Jean Grey, and we're just going to tell stories. And then it ties in, and it's kind of like, oh, wait, why are you bringing the old continuity back? That doesn't matter anymore. And honestly, and I liked the Wolverine sequence just fine.
I think but it cut, like, it had nothing to do with the fucking anything in the movie.
It was, it's a rough structural problem with the movie. I do wonder if Hugh Jackman is a problem with the series now, that he probably needs to go, because I think him being as popular a part of the series as he is, even though he is phenomenal, and I have nothing, I cannot say enough good things about how good he is as Wolverine, and always has been, and that he anchored those early movies when nothing else was working, and things like that. He is, I think, every bit as important to modern superhero history as Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think Days of Future Past should have been his last appearance. It would have been the perfect ending point for him. He gets his happy ending. He has really fought for it. And that could just, and he's off with the old continuity where he belongs, because that's what he's from. And we could just say goodbye. But their insistence on keeping him around in this one, they're making another movie with him. It is probably going to be his last, but he's waffled on that a little bit. I think that shows kind of they're not sure what to do with the continuity, and that's too bad, because I think they have a lot of pieces in place here. Michael Fassbender is tremendous as Magneto. James McAvoy is a really good Professor X. Jennifer Lawrence was fundamentally miscast, but that's not her fault. That's a fault completely of the writing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they've got the pieces, and I think they cast some people really well here. I love Sophie Turner as Jean Grey. I think that's smart casting. And I liked their new Cyclops has more personality than old Cyclops ever did. So that's nice. And if they do more with him, maybe we could get some good Cyclops stuff. But the question at the end of this movie is, okay, Bryan Singer, you're using the iconography from your original movies. It feels like you're doing like the tying off, this is how we connect it. But I would like to see a movie with Jean Grey and Cyclops. And you can't do that if you're doing that.
No.
And I feel like what probably has to happen is from this point on, and it's going to be awkward, but you probably just have to ignore the original continuity, move on, do your characters, have fun, probably forget about the time period stuff, because that's gotten really messy.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's kind of this web that they've tangled themselves into, and I understand every individual step along the way, but when you look at it in totality, it's like, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And it's tough, and it is because X-Men is the oldest superhero franchise on film at this point.
Yeah, that's ongoing.
Ongoing. Yeah. It's, you know, been 16 years without ever technically having a reboot, and I do admire them on some level for that, because, you know, we've seen the bad versions of that with Amazing Spider-Man and stuff, and that Spider-Man got fucked so hard they're on their third goddamn Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I mean, their new Spider-Man is awesome, but it's still silly that we have three in 16 years. But yeah, it's a weird scenario, and it does mute some of the enthusiasm I have for parts of this movie that I really did like. Like, I really liked Sophie Turner as Jean Grey, and I like her on Game of Thrones. I think she's become a very confident young actress, and I think she's really good here, like in a way that there's a personality and a confidence to that character that they never had in the original movies.
Yeah.
And I do think it's fun to see Bryan Singer get to do that character in a way where she feels like a part of this universe that's not obligatory. Same with Cyclops. Like, this is the first X-Men movie that doesn't seem like it hates Cyclops.
Yeah.
Like, the early scenes with him are fun in just a fun superhero origin kind of way. The Michael Fassbender stuff early on, it is 100% in a different movie. And I will acknowledge that right up front. But that, again, if you cut that little movie together, I think that's a really good Magneto short film.
Yeah.
Just like the beginning of The Wolverine, I really love that first, like, 15 minutes with him in the forest.
Yeah.
Things like that. And oftentimes, X-Men movies are more about the individual moments you like rather than the whole, because the whole has never really worked.
Yeah.
So things like that I liked. I will get into the actual villain and all that. I like Apocalypse. I liked all of that stuff. I liked some of the lore here. But yeah, you get to the end, and I agree with you. It does not feel like the movie fully knows what it wants to be. And I do wonder, you talked about kind of the iconography, that they use the original Cerebro and the mansion and all that. And I don't have any visual design problems with that. I like that just fine. But I do think you're probably right in the idea of it has to be abandoned if, for nothing else, it gives a certain impression.
Yeah.
Right? Because I don't think on the page that last scene has to be so prequel, we're setting it up.
Yeah.
Like, purely on the page, especially because it's fucking Mystique leading it. It's very different. Yeah. But Bryan Singer is Bryan Singer. He can't stop being Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
He shoots it like a Bryan Singer movie, and he references his own work as he is wont and most directors are wont to do. And so it creates this sense of iconography and connection that if you just look at this movie on its own, I guess it's fine, but it's hard to look at the movie on its own because it is calling back to things from a long time ago now in film years.
Yeah, no, it's... Yeah, that ending of the movie, like, really, like, was, like, the killing blow for me of, like, this feels like an ending to a totally different movie. Because the rest of the movie is not building up to that. And I guess I want to... Let's talk about some of the stuff that you said you really liked that I also, on its own, liked, but is also, like, the way that the movie handles it makes me kind of dislike it in retrospect in different ways. So, like, the Jean Grey and Cyclops stuff, like, I like that stuff on its own to the, like, so much to the extent that, like, when the movie transitioned into, like, them going to get Apocalypse and all that stuff, like, I felt like, God damn it, why are we in this movie now? Why can't we be back in the movie where Cyclops, Jean Grey, Jubilee, and Nightcrawler all get in a cool old-fashioned car and drive to the movie theater and watch Return of the Jedi and skip class? Like, that's the X-Men movie I fucking want to see, and you get, like, 8 minutes of it total in this whole fucking, like, 2 hour, like, 23-minute long movie. Like, you get such a tiny sliver of it that, like... Like, Jean Grey and Cyclops are never given time to feel like they develop into characters or have any real character arc. There's, like, lip service paid to, like, I'm Cyclops and I can't really control my powers. And I'm Jean Grey and I can't really control my powers. And in the last fight, they both fight Apocalypse, but and they're effective in that in the last fight. But it doesn't feel like they went on some sort of journey where they learned how to use their powers and became self-confident over the course of it. It's like they just say, this is what my character is. And then at the end of it, where they say, I am now improved. But you don't actually get any of the story and the narrative along the way to justify that character evolution. It just happens. Because there's no time in the movie for anything to just, like, naturally progress. Because it's juggling so many characters and so many subplots with Quicksilver and Magneto and Apocalypse and Xavier and Moira McTaggart and Mystique and Cyclops and Jean Grey and Nightcrawler and Psylocke and Archangel and Storm. And, like, oh, there's so many characters and so much fucking bullshit going on. Just like X-Men 3 and the old Bryan Singer X-Men movies. That's, like, there's no time to sit down and be like, who is Cyclops? What makes him really interesting? That you only get that brief snippet, and what's so tragic about it is that brief snippet at the beginning is really interesting and feels like if we had a movie that was about Cyclops, like, discovering his powers when he's in high school and, like, that sort of traumatizing him and him, like, his brother sort of, like, taking him over to the Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters and he starts studying there and he meets Jean Grey and they, like, start to, like they start to fall in love and stuff. And it's, like, a sort of high school story that then maybe there are some bigger stakes that happen along the way in a larger fight. That's an interesting X-Men movie where you can focus on a character and a small cast of his friends and stuff around him. And that would be a fine X-Men movie. Instead, it feels like they took, like, an idea for that kind of movie and put it in a handful of scenes sprinkled across this one. So that's my problem with the Cyclops and Jean Grey thing.
Oh, well, can I say something about that? Yeah. No, and I agree with that because I really like those scenes too. And evidently someone at Fox does too, because the next movie they have an active production for X-Men is they're making a New Mutants movie.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Based on that Chris Claremont arc from the, I think, 80s.
Yes,
yeah. And I know they're going to use the mutants from that arc, but they also want to bring in some of this younger cast, like Jean Grey and Cyclops. And I think that's probably really smart. I think that could be a really good movie if you go smaller scale. James McAvoy can kind of be the elder statesman there to just kind of be the teacher, like Patrick Stewart used to be. But you can just focus on the kids. And it would not surprise me if they looked at those scenes and said, this is good. We could do something with this. And it also speaks, though, within this movie, though, to the larger problem the X-Men franchise on film has always had.
Yeah.
X-Men is a TV show. X-Men is a comic book. Yeah. X-Men is not a movie series because when you do an X-Men movie, movies have to have a center. And X-Men just doesn't really have that center. It is an ensemble, pure and simple.
Yeah.
But unless you choose that ensemble really carefully, and they've never really gotten it perfect in these X-Men movies, it's really tough to do. There's a reason why Deadpool, if you include it in the larger X-Men cinematic universe, is probably the most enjoyed one by audiences because it's one character and you can do that really well and just drill down and do a 90-minute Deadpool movie. You know, they're never going to give $200 million to make the X-Men movie that is just young Cyclops and Jean Grey hanging out at school.
Yeah.
As good as that would be. And so it has to become maybe a spin-off kind of thing. So it's serving too many masters, and I do think Apocalypse, if nothing else, kind of winds up showing the limits of what they can do with X-Men on film, at least in this kind of conventional model.
Yeah, but like I think what's so frustrating about it is that it felt like, well, X-Men First Class was not perfect in that regard, and a lot of the actual first class of X-Men were not particularly interesting characters, like Havoc. Like, that movie did have a heart, which, like, this movie references, and it's probably the best part of this whole movie is whenever it cuts two scenes from First Class with Xavier and Magneto from X-Men First Class. Their relationship in that movie was so great and so interesting and carried that movie. And while, like, it had some of those issues with the first class of mutants, the relationship between Xavier and Magneto was strong enough to carry that movie, and like was, and it felt like they had found a way to kind of like fix that problem within that movie. If not, they didn't execute it perfectly. It felt like they were on their way to solving that. And then just feels like Days of Future Past had some of that, but not quite as much of it, but it was still a good movie. And but still had like a stronger focus because I think it had a more effective kind of plot center instead of a character center. And then,
well, but it still had a character center. It's Magneto, yeah. It's Professor X, and it's Wolverine.
Yeah, but it's less about their character development than it is about like the more like sort of broader plot machinations in Days of Future Past, and like First Class is very much a character piece about those two.
Right.
And this feels like it doesn't have either of those things, because like Apocalypse is kind of whatever as a villain. He's fine. But like the plot of the movie is not interesting in the way that the plot of Days of Future Past or the time travel stuff is inherently kind of like fascinating, because it's complex. Even if it's complex in structure, if not in like thematic depth or anything, but it has a mystery element to it. It has something for the audience to focus on and to sort of pay attention to. Here, like, Apocalypse is a big blue guy who wants to take over the world. Like, there's like he's fine as a villain, but like he doesn't hold the movie. And like the characters don't have, as I said, they don't have a strong arc, and they don't center on. Like Professor X and Magneto are barely even in the movie together at all. Like, it doesn't have that kind of center.
And it's tough, because the whole time I was watching the movie, though, I can see where they were going with it, though. Like, it really does feel like this is a rough first draft of a script of a better X-Men movie. Because I kept seeing the places where I thought they were going kind of thematically, or they could go, and at some point it got either overstuffed, or they didn't connect the dots. But I can totally see how, okay, your backdrop is Apocalypse, who's the big threat, and you can use that kind of generic thing to tell a more kind of high pressure story for these characters. That's a really common superhero thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Avengers to a certain degree and things like that, where you have the threat in the background so you can have the characters get together. That's what you need. And I can see them doing that, because you could have Professor X kind of, as you say, if the story is this is him figuring out how to form the X-Men and stuff, that's fine to tell as a story if you commit to it and actually do it. They don't really do that. With Magneto, it's Magneto figuring out, okay, I am done with humanity, fuck these people, and he's going to side with Apocalypse because you understand why he would do it in that moment.
Yeah, sure.
And if you fully followed through on that and basically turned him into Ian McKellen at the start of X-Men 1, then that works as an arc for me. I totally think it does, because where we've left him before, he's not there yet. He's never quite been there, but then kind of back off on that. The most baffling thing in the whole movie on that level to me, where you can clearly see there were dots that were never connected in the script, is the Quicksilver stuff.
Yeah.
And I think, I love the Quicksilver scene in this, where he's going, I think it's a fun callback to Days of Future Past. I think they had fun with that. I think Evan Peters is good, and I wish they would, again, focus, give him more to do, because I think he's good in these. But anyway, you have, they're doing the thing, you know, Quicksilver, as in the comics, is Magneto's son.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very conspicuously does not have a twin sister this time around.
Yes. Well, you know, they can't. I thought they were kind of suggesting that Magneto's daughter who gets killed is supposed to be Scarlet Witch.
But her powers are totally different.
Okay.
I don't know if there's a character like that in the comics or not.
Okay. Well, anyway, but let's see. So, what was I going to say? So, Quicksilver, he's Magneto's son. Okay, let's see where they go with this.
Yeah.
They don't go anywhere with it.
Nope.
It's really weird, because what I thought they were setting up is Magneto loses his family in the beginning of the movie. Quicksilver goes to try to meet his dad and kind of redeem him. Okay, interesting character motivation. That can work on a script level. And he goes to Egypt with everyone, and he and Mystique are the ones who go to save Magneto, because they have kind of the clearest relationship with him.
Yeah.
And Charles is off. He's been kidnapped.
Yeah.
So as
he's going bald.
Yeah. Which, I love that the whole movie basically is an origin story for his baldness.
Sure. That's what
anyway,
we're going to
use. So we have that. He goes to Magneto, and I thought he was going to say, I'm your son, and that would make Magneto realize, okay, that's why I have connections. I'm not going to kill my son. There is hope for me, and we could do that. Now, I think that would depend on the execution, because that could be really bad or really good, depending on how you do it.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is they don't do it at all, and so you just leave that dangling, and I don't understand why Magneto stops doing what he's doing. I don't fully understand his motivations, and I really don't understand why Professor X forgives him in this one, because he kills an incredible amount of people in this movie.
I mean, not even just in this movie, like, he's killed hundreds of thousands of people just in these ones. Like,
yeah.
Not even, like, obviously you can't take in X-Men 1 through 3 yet, but... Yeah, he's killed a lot of people at this point.
And really how the movie ends is him and Xavier just giving him a standing invitation, like, we're buddies, you can come back whenever.
Yeah.
And again, it's that weird thing of, like, the movie at the end wants to be the connecting piece, and yet it's moved Magneto and Mystique specifically way far away from who they were in the original movies. So, and it's, and again, that's where I just say the dots being, because those dots, individual dots, I like. And I think Magneto starts out with such a strong and compelling character arc in this, and it goes nowhere, and that's very strange to me.
Yeah. And I guess for me, like, my problem with the Magneto stuff is, while I think that the scene at the beginning of him with his family and him losing his family, that's like, it's well made and interesting on its own, seeing as, like, it, as a piece of his character through these three movies, from First Class, Days of Future Past to here, it just feels like, God damn it, they have no idea what they want Magneto to be anymore. Because it feels like he is just constantly waffling between, I'm evil, but, like, I can still be redeemed, and I'm kind of okay, but I'm evil, and I can be redeemed, and I'm kind of okay, but I'm evil, but I can be redeemed, and I'm kind of okay, and I'm evil. And it's the same thing that they have Mystique do, where it's like, I don't want to embrace my mutant powers. I'm going to embrace my mutant powers. I don't want to embrace my mutant... I'm going to embrace my... I don't want to. Okay, I guess I'll embrace my mutant powers. Like, both of those characters have, like, done that exact same thing, like, two or three times in all of these movies. And it's like, it was fine in First Class, because the first time it did it, it was just their character arc. It was, like, slightly repetitive in Days of Future Past, but it wasn't the focus, so it was okay.
They also pretty firmly at the end of that movie, he's the bad guy at the end, he is the antagonist, and he and Xavier do not make nice at the end of that
one. And then at the beginning of this movie, he has somehow, like, managed to just sort of disappear, have a family, and lose his family. And, like, that, while that's, like... like I said, it's compelling as, like, this, like, short film or something, taken as something that his character, like, his part of his character arc, it felt incredibly cheap to me, of just, like, he just, like went into the woods and just had a family out of nowhere off screen in between these two movies, and then they just die so he can be evil again, because we need to give him a reason to be evil again. It's like just fucking let Magneto be evil at some point. Like, trying to keep, like, force him to be sympathetic all the time just feels like a really cheap narrative move that, like, is so completely unearned. Like, there's nothing about his characterization to me that felt like, oh yeah, of course he's going to go off into the woods and have a family, and this random woman's going to be okay with shacking up with the dude what killed tens of thousands of people last movie. Like, it's just, that seems so manufactured and ridiculous to me.
And I get it. It's again something I'd be okay with if they, or I would enjoy more if they fully followed through on it.
Yeah.
You know, if he ends this movie, and again, this is the weird thing. In the original three X-Men movies, the character Ian McKellen plays is bad. Like, there is no, there are things where he is empathetic, he is sympathetic in some cases, we understand why he does what he does, but he is never not the antagonist.
Yeah.
Like, he briefly teams up with them in X2, and then at the end he tries to kill every human on the planet.
Yeah.
Because that's what Magneto does.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that is one thing. They had that character right start to finish in all three of those movies. My favorite parts of The Last Stand are the Magneto stuff. It's great. They knew what to do with him. And I do agree, at this point, it seemed like they did know what to do with Michael Fassbender in the first and second movies. You get to this one, and half the movie I thought they knew what they were doing with him, and then it goes nowhere, and that's where it shines back, and I agree it can feel cheap that way. Because, again, I'm okay with, if we're taking the 10-year time jump seriously, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and you say, okay, he had a bad day in Days of Future Past, he's trying to just completely distance himself from all humanity, learns he can't do that, and that's when he goes full supervillain. Okay, that's an arc over three movies. I can accept that, and if this was the last push we needed, whatever. It's well played by Michael Fassbender. I thought it was well directed. I'm okay with that. But it's really not. It's a minor arc within this movie, and ultimately he... I mean, his big moment is saying, no, I betrayed them. And it's like, I don't believe that, Magneto. You don't like them.
I mean, yes! Two movies ago, you did that, buddy.
Yeah.
After you did that, you're kind of not in a position to betray them anymore. It's been like 20 years.
Yeah. So let's talk about the time jump stuff.
Okay.
It's hilarious. Because, okay, the character's not visibly aging. I can write that off by they're mutants and whatever.
Sure.
Not that's an actual power.
No.
I'm
they're not all Wolverine. They don't all work like that, you racist.
I know. I'm just joking. But you can do that. Fuck, the weird stuff, though, is when they bring Rose Byrne in as Moira McTaggart.
Yeah.
Normal human looks identical, because Rose Byrne is only 5 years older or whatever.
Yeah.
She doesn't look any different. But Moira McTaggart would ostensibly be, like, in her late 50s at this point.
Yeah, she apparently, like, in between this movie and First Class, she got married and had a kid and was divorced. I feel like that would put some age on anybody.
Yes. So everyone's supposed to be 20 years older from First Class. Like, the funniest one to think about... Okay, so I'll get to there in a second.
Yeah.
So back to Moira McTaggart, though. So that means Professor X has been crushing on this woman that he erased her mind for 20 years.
Yeah.
And now goes back, and it's like no time passed. That stuff's kind of weird.
I mean, it does, when you think about it, though, it really recontextualizes that line he has earlier where he, like, first sees her in Cerebro, and he, like, is like, oh, she looks great. It's like, yeah, no, you're right. She really does look great for this, like, 50-year-old woman.
Yes, indeed. So you have that. The funniest one, though, I mean, there's other silly things, like Quicksilver never left his mom's basement.
Yeah.
And again, none of this ruins the movie for me. This is just the silly stuff. But then you get into, okay, so in this one they've said Alex Summers is Scott Summers' older brother.
Yes.
So, which is a reverse from the comics, which on its own, yeah, whatever, that happens all the time in comic book movies. But what's weird is that if Alex Summers was like 16-year-old Havoc in First Class 20 years ago, that means Scott could not have been born at the time. So Alex would have, like, he would never have, like, grown up with this baby brother. It would have been born after he already became an X-Man.
Yeah.
That's all very weird.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't look any different.
So. No, I think his hair's longer. But again, I don't remember what he looked like in the first movie, so I might be wrong. Maybe he had the long hair then.
Yeah, so the continuity definitely, if you get into it, it's a head-scratcher.
Yeah. I mean, the one character that is totally fine, does not look aged at all, is Mystique. Because she is like that from the comics. That's fair.
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing with Mystique. That is the biggest...
Yeah, let's talk about Mystique.
It's been consistently the weak spot in these three new movies, which overall I've liked.
But it's been consistently getting a weaker and weaker spot, I would say.
Because it's just like... And again, I don't inherently ever want to jump into, it's not like the character we know, but it's so far away, you can't not have that conversation. And above and beyond that, though, even if you just take her on her own, pretend there is no comics, there is no other Mystique, she makes no sense as a character in these movies.
No.
In part because it really, Jennifer Lawrence does not want to be there. I feel like she's been in each one less. She's had less of... I guess in Days of Future Past, she has a major role in the plot.
She became like the mutant messiah at the end of Days of Future. I completely forgot that she was that important.
Yes, she is important in that one, and I think that's probably the best they've used her in these movies so far, but it's still confusing. And then you get to hear, and she has no inclination towards being a bad person.
Yeah.
She has no inclination towards really being all that mysterious. She doesn't shapeshift. She barely is ever blue. All these things. So it's like her. She's basically, honestly, Bryan Singer redoing his version of Rogue. Of someone who doesn't want to be a mutant, but is and is reluctant. She has more in common with that. And that, not that that Rogue has anything to do with the Rogue from TV show or comics. But like, so it's just, it's a character who doesn't really make sense. And especially if you consider there was a character named Mystique who was very prominent in the first three movies directed by Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
This character has zero resemblance.
No, not at all.
The color of the paint. That's the only thing. That's the only thing. And so it's very confusing, especially when you end and now she's the leader of the X-Men somehow. None of it makes sense.
Like, if watching this movie felt like Bryan Singer listened to our podcast where we talked about X-Men First Class like 5 years ago, where I talked about how like it really annoyed me that they took the Mystique character, who's this really awesome, like mysterious villain from the comics, and like they made her this character that you knew everything about because you saw her at her childhood, and made her like this like erstwhile good guy and all this stuff. And like he like hates me personally because this fucking movie, it's like, she is, like, the great hero that, like, Storm and all these mutants look up to. And when they see her, it's like, oh, it's Mystique. It's the great hero. We aspire to be her. It's like, what? It's like the beginning of this movie, like, she goes to Germany to find, like, fucking where Angel and Nightcrawler are in this, like, weird, like, mutant fight, like, thing. And it was, like, the back of my mind is like, well, I guess, yeah, they're definitely not having Nightcrawler be her kid in this one. When Nightcrawler is Mystique's son from the comics.
Okay.
Just like, not doing that. So it's like, okay, I'll just, fine. Enough time has passed that it totally could have happened. But fair enough, we're not dealing with that. And then, like, Then they, like, do the whole stupid thing where she's, like, for the fifth fucking time, she decides, like, I don't want to, like, I just want to look like Jennifer Lawrence all the time. I don't want to embrace my mutant identity. To the point where, you're right, there is only one time in the entire movie at the very beginning with the Nightcrawler stuff where she ever shapeshifts into anybody else. She is either Jennifer Lawrence or in the blue paint for the entire movie.
And very briefly.
Yeah, you practically don't even see it. It's like a half second shot where she becomes like a security guard or something. She says, oh, get her over there. And then she turns back. And that's it. Like, if you blinked during that scene and you had never seen any other X-Men movie, you literally wouldn't know that her power is to shapeshift into other people. You would know that her power would be to become blue. That would be her power. Right? In her default state is probably Jennifer Lawrence.
The thing is, I can totally believe that being a shitty D-list X-Men, he becomes blue.
I mean, there's a lot of blue people in this movie. There's Mystique, there's Beast, there's Apocalypse, and there's Nightcrawler. It's like Fox, like, heard all the discussion about, like, whitewashing in Hollywood and how there's not enough representation for minorities, and nobody told anyone that normal people aren't born colored blue. Because there's a lot of minority roles in this movie. There's four blue people.
Avatar is just game-changing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it really like broke the barriers down.
Avatar is the Spike Lee movie of blue people.
Exactly.
All right. Anyway, yes.
But yeah, fuck how they use Mystique in this movie. She ends this by becoming the leader of the X-Men. She is Mystique. She's one of the most recognizable villains in all of X-Men. It's Magneto, it's Mystique, and it's fucking Sabretooth, and then it's Apocalypse. How did somehow Mystique become... She's occupying the Cyclops role of the team. How the fuck did that happen? How have we come so far when I can watch a fucking Marvel movie that has, like, Captain America, Iron Man, Ant-Man, Black Panther, fucking Spider-Man, Black Widow, Hawkeye, the War Machine. Like, every fucking superhero you can imagine, and all of them are basically represented more or less faithfully from, like, their core elements from the comics. And then I go watch an X-Men movie that, like, is, like, the eighth X-Men movie, and they've gotten further away from how to portray Mystique in a way that feels faithful to her character from the comics. How are we still doing this?
It's very strange with Mystique, especially, because even if her origin would have been off and demystifying her in First Class, Matthew Vaughn, who directed and wrote that movie, was clearly setting up for her to become the evil Mystique we knew.
She ends that movie by joining up with Magneto. Like, it's, like, the end of that fucking movie.
And so, weirdly, it's Bryan Singer who clearly made the decision to go on a different road with her.
That's true.
And that's weird. That's the weirdest part. And I don't know where it comes from. I think a lot of this is Jennifer Lawrence's reluctance, and I don't want to put it on her. I don't want to say she's wrong or anything, but clearly you have an actress who doesn't want to be there, doesn't want to be in the blue paint. You have to write around that. Why not write her out? Honestly, this movie would be so much... She's... And as much as we talk about it, she's not in it much. She's there, but in terms of actual lines of dialogue and, like, plot function, she barely matters to this movie.
But it feels like the movie constantly is referencing her, that's even when she's not there.
So, but I'm saying, I think you could write her out very easily. Mystique is off doing something else. Focus. And then you could have the movie end with Cyclops giving the speech. Or Jean Grey. Both of them together. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
You know, and have them play that role and kind of be the new young leaders of the X-Men. And that would play so much stronger. So it is this weird... It's like they made decisions three movies ago, and they never figured out how to write around that.
Yeah.
And so, it's bad franchise management at that point. With the blue people.
Yes.
I want to say on, like, a production level, I love that it's still all makeup. I do the look of everyone. And I Apocalypse, I know he's not the most exciting villain in the world. I did like him here. I thought Oscar Isaac was a good choice for that. I thought he did good work. I enjoyed kind of his... And it's another thing that I almost wish we got more of, like a more Apocalypse-focused movie, because I thought his whole thing of him fully believing he's a god and trying to convert people to his cause and all this, I found him kind of an interesting, charismatic villain in that mold. I really loved the opening scene in Egypt, which was just kind of craziness, and I thought, well, that's kind of something I haven't seen before in one of these movies, so that was fun. So I liked him. I liked some of the scenes of him going and getting his followers and stuff. I really liked the makeup on Apocalypse and how they depicted some of his powers. Yeah. There's a lot of cool visuals in this movie. But I don't know how much there even is more to say. It's a movie with some good parts, some very good parts, even some promising things that does not cohere. And your level of tolerance will vary.
Clearly. Yeah, yeah. No, but, like, there's other... Just, like, to, like, mention some of the other things that kind of, like, bugged me in a weird way. It's that X-Men problem where it feels like every single X-Men movie just is weirdly compelled to throw in like five more mutants than they need. That they have the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which that's the thing. And they but like the sum of the story, it's like Psylocke is there, played by Olivia Munn, and I almost burst out laughing in the movie at the end after the battle, for the big climactic battle is over, and it like cuts to Psylocke and she's like standing behind some fire and some sinister movie plays and she slinks off into the darkness. Like that's a setup for the next movie where it's like, oh no, Psylocke survived and she's gonna be, it's like, she has like two lines of dialogue in the whole movie. She does nothing. She has no character. I have like, I don't know much about Psylocke from the comic books, but I know enough to know that it's like, she's not some weird mutant bouncer. Like, she's an awesome ninja lady, and, like, none of that element is there with her character. She's just sort of there, and it's just, like, it just so fucking cuts to her and plays, like, this is, like, sinister sting of orchestra music, and she slinks off behind the flames to, like, terrorize the X-Men one another day. It's like, nobody in this fucking theater. Like, I watched this movie with my dad, and he hadn't, like, didn't know what her name was. Nobody in that theater that didn't know her from the comics had any idea who that character was. Like Angel in this movie, where they do the Archangel thing, which that's a thing from the original Apocalypse arc in the comics, is Angel loses his wings and then Apocalypse gives him metal wings and sort of like brainwashes him to become evil and becomes Archangel, which is like a big dramatic arc in the comics because Angel was a character that dates back to the 60s. Here you just meet this weird version of Angel who's this like German, like the fucking like mutant gladiator dude who loses his wings and he's just kind of a drunk asshole and then he dies at the end, I guess, and that's kind of it. And then Storm, that's another one where it's like, how, when the fuck does Storm become Storm from those other X-Men movies where she feels like she does not, she's just sort of thrown in there because she's a popular X-Men character who's also not a villain.
No, and I liked the actress. I think if they she's the right actress for Storm. She'd have to, it's kind of funny, you go for the biggest thing, I mean, this is how little they care. She has a strong accent in this one that Halle Berry didn't do. I actually probably like her more with the accent. But it's
In this movie, fine. Like, I think she would be good as Storm in a movie that gave a shit about Storm as a character, where Storm is like one of the X-Men. Like, she's one of the most iconic characters from the franchise, and it feels so weird for her to just be chucked in as one of the Horsemen of the Apocalypse as sort of an afterthought because I guess they couldn't think of someone else.
Yeah, and I mean, she's not a complete afterthought because she is the one who introduces Apocalypse into everything and she's there the whole time.
But it feels like that happens, but then like they don't ever give her a character moment really. I mean, she defies Apocalypse at the end, but that's like so... she hasn't had a line in the movie for an hour and a half at that point.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, I want to go back to, I understand the movie's got issues. I've never said it didn't. Yeah. I think, and I preface this with this, if the many problems in this movie bother you, I 100% get it, and if that cripples the movie for you, I 100% get it. This is not one of those cases where I'm out of step with critics and I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't even know what an example would be, but like, you know, that kind of thing. I have reverses where critics liked something and I thought it was stupid. I don't usually go the other way around. But I honestly, moment to moment, I really enjoyed watching the movie. I have a weird dual reaction. I like Bryan Singer directing superhero movies. I think he's good at it. I don't know if at this point he's good for X-Men.
I think they
need to move on from him, and I think they need to get, like when they brought Matthew Vaughn in for First Class, which was a very inspired moment in the history of this series.
Yeah.
If they could get someone else in like that who can put a new stamp on it and kind of just right the ship. I don't think, you know, X-Men is lost on film or anything. I think, you know, again, as much as we're laughing with the continuity stuff, I don't think it's the biggest problem at the end of the day.
It's definitely not the biggest problem with this movie.
No, and it's not the biggest, you know, comic book. It's kind of a miracle, frankly, that this is the only comic book franchise with crazy continuity.
Yeah.
Because that should happen. Just look at the comics right now on Marvel and DC. This is small potatoes compared to that stuff.
Okay, wait for Flash Season 7, and then you're going to be ruining the day that they introduced the multiverse in Season 2.
Yes. Well, anyway. But no, I think Bryan Singer needs to move on. If he would like to direct other superhero movies, now, God, I wish he was still doing Superman. That'd be so much better than what we have right now. But
they should just make Superman Returns 2. Fuck it. Let's do it.
I'd watch it. Bring Brandon Routh back. Yeah. He was a good Superman, damn it.
Yeah.
He's a good actor. He's playing Adam now. He could be Adam could be in the Superman movie and he could play both parts.
Sure.
It'd be fun. Yeah.
I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Yeah. Anyway. But I enjoyed a lot of this movie. I enjoyed it scene to scene. I liked Apocalypse. I liked the different action sequences. I enjoyed a lot of the characters. It's almost like I thought about writing a review for this movie when I got home. And I realized my reaction is almost non-critical. I don't know. I don't get this way about movies, but I just kind of viewed it casually. And I just kind of had fun with it. And I enjoyed it. But I'm not saying that, I guess, to negate if you didn't like it. But also to say, I think if you did like it, I do think there are valid reasons here. I think it's... I thought it moved along fine. I liked a lot of the acting. I liked a lot of the individual scenes. You know, it is weirdly structured where the second act is about William Stryker and whatever. They could not get rid of that character.
Could have totally been just cut out of the movie and you wouldn't even notice.
I guess not. But anyway, that's X-Men Apocalypse. Weird conflicted reaction.
Sorry, I saw this movie earlier today, so I'm still coming off of it.
Okay.
So like I'm still thinking of stuff that I had an issue with and... The last thing I will say is, God damn it, the end of the movie, when they do the Phoenix stuff with Jean Grey, again, why? They already did it. Ruined the character. Fucking shit. Just, why does everything involving Jean Grey always have to be the fucking Phoenix Force? Just don't do it anymore.
So can I say something and then let you go off on it?
Yeah,
again?
Okay, go ahead.
X-Men I really only know the movies. I've seen the animated series, like parts of it. I've never like sat down and, I did not watch that as a kid regularly.
Right.
I've never read the comics, so I don't even know the Phoenix stuff. I don't know anything about this stuff. But I liked Jean Grey in this movie, and at the end, I liked all that. I think actually there's a lot of visually really cool stuff. I like how Xavier is fighting Apocalypse in their kind of mental realm while Apocalypse is fighting everyone else outside. I liked all of that. I liked Jean Grey getting in on that. And the visual of the Phoenix I thought was fine and cool. And it didn't affect... I thought it was a fine ending. But maybe that's... I guess other audiences who don't know anything about Phoenix would maybe feel that way. But again, I don't know anything about that character arc. Yeah. So what...
Well, for me, it's that like... It's a couple of things. It's one... Like, I do not want to paint myself as a huge X-Men fan from the comics, because I'm not. Like, I have read some X-Men stuff, and, like, one of the only X-Men comics that I've, like, or, like, arcs that I've read significantly, like, basically read the whole thing, is the Apocalypse one. And so, like, I've read most of the, like, original Phoenix arc, and but I don't remember much of it. So I don't want to say this like I'm some sort of X-Men expert, but, like, the thing with the Phoenix Force and all that shit with Jean Grey is that, like, it was a very popular comic arc for her when it first happened, and, like, where, like, the Phoenix Force stuff takes her over, and it's all, like, kind of really confusing comic book stuff. I don't remember much of it. But then after that happened, everything involving that character forever now is always the Phoenix stuff. It is always 100% whenever she comes up. It's always about the fucking Phoenix stuff all the time. It so dominates her character. And that's also true of the original X-Men movies, that her whole thing in those movies is that it develops to, like, where she's, like, becoming Phoenix, and then in X-Men 3, it's, like, that's the whole plot of X-Men 3, is she's Phoenix, and she's evil, and she kills Cyclops, and she kills Professor X, and all this stuff, and everyone has to stop her. And it's just, like... At the end of this movie, when it's like they have Jean Grey back and like they then do the like very explicitly like, Jean, release your power, just let go, Jean. And she goes, ah! And then like the Phoenix stuff pops out of her. It's just as like, you motherfuckers, you already did it. You already did the Phoenix stuff. And it's like, if they even think about doing anything with that in any future X-Men movies, I am totally fucking out. I am done with this whole franchise. I'm not... It's like, you already did it in your worst movie that you have that's not X-Men Origins. I was going to say your worst movie that you did completely cut out of the continuity, but they cut both of those out of the continuity. But, like, one of your worst movies, you already did the Phoenix stuff, because it's a hard story arc to do. I don't think it's that interesting. It's been redone to death. You shouldn't do it. You should just let the character be the character, not be dominated by this whole Phoenix story arc. And so, but then, like, when they just fucking reference it again... You don't need to, because you already did it. Like, just put that away. Because it's also another element where it's like, it feels like, oh, another thing the Phoenix stuff is used for a lot is as this very blatant Deus Ex Machina kind of storytelling. And that's very much what it sort of feels like here, where it's like, well, you know, Apocalypse is really strong. How do we beat him? Well, the Phoenix is really strong. We'll just let her be Phoenix for like half a second. It's like, okay, day is saved. And it's fine. It's fine if that's all it ever is. But since, like, you know, the Jean Grey character is going to, this version of that character is presumably going to continue in the future X-Men movies, if they fucking keep on doing it, I'm going to fucking kill someone. It drives me nuts that they can't just let that
character. So just let Jean Grey be a strong telepath who's learning to control her powers.
Yeah, like, it doesn't have to be all this crazy Phoenix stuff, especially when you already have done the entire story arc in this same movie franchise. It's not even a reboot. It's the same franchise. Don't cover ground you've already covered. Like, it's just, it's crazy to me that they decided to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. So fuck that Phoenix stuff. Stop it.
Let's talk about something unambiguously good.
Okay, yeah, let's do that.
And I'm not sure there are many more things in this world more unambiguously good than Doom 2016.
Yes, the Doom. The Doom, Doom to Doom.
All right,
Doom,
so
all capitalized.
Sean,
yeah.
You talked about Doom last week on the podcast.
Yes, I was about halfway through it.
The new game from id Software and Bethesda for the PS4 and Xbox One and PC and all that good stuff.
Yep.
And you were close to being done with the campaign or halfway through or something,
yeah.
And you really loved it.
Yes.
That was great. I got it this week. Did you get the physical copy of it?
No, I just downloaded
Okay. I brought it because the fucking... I have to start here. This is when I knew I would love this game. I bought the physical copy of Doom. And you get it on the PS4, or I assume it's the same on the Xbox One. And you get it, and you open it up, and the main cover art, it's okay. It's just, it's the Doom guy.
Yeah.
It's, and it's like, it's fine. It's a normal first-person shooter cover. Nothing wrong with it, but nothing all that exciting. But you open up the case, and there's a full-on reversible cover. And you put that reversible cover on, and it's like an original, like, 1990-whatever.
1993.
1993 Doom. It's not the same, but it's, like, in that style. And it is so awesome.
Yeah.
And it just looks great. It's, like, very high quality, the printing quality of it, I think. And so, like, ever since then, I immediately reversed the cover and put it in there. And so I've had it, you know, sitting on my table when I'm at the TV.
Yeah.
And every moment I'm not playing Doom and I look down and I see that, I want to play Doom. That is the best video game cover we have had in years.
Yeah. And it may be the single greatest, like, video game title treatment that has ever been done. Like, their logo for Doom in this is so good. It's so just... And it's the reason why I feel like... This, like, referring to this Doom, it just has to be Doom all capitalized. That's the right way to write about this game and not call it Doom 2016. It's just Doom all caps. Because it's just, like, that's the kind of presence it has, the weight it carries.
Yes, I mean, it is always an annoying thing when there's something and then you just name the new thing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Like, new Doom, new Ghostbusters, all that stuff. It's like, give it a subtitle, guys, or a number. But when I saw this cover, I'm like, that's why they just called it Doom. Because it's so powerful on its own.
Yeah.
Even if you just added like 4 at the end, it wouldn't be as cool.
Yeah.
So we can just call it Doom 4 if we want, or The Doom or whatever. But this is why it's got to be Doom. So it's just the whole thing. It's so awesome. I just want to bring it because we've got to have it out while we're talking about the game.
Yes.
Because it looks so fucking cool. Anyway, so I got this and I was like, I was giddy before I even put the game in. And it's like, we need more of this kind of stuff because this is why in theory, I like physical media because it can make you really excited to play the thing if it's a good package. Like when we got like Persona 4 Dancing All Night and it's this giant package for your Vita and it's got the soundtrack and everything. It's like, I'm happy with this game before I've even put it in.
Yeah.
That's what you got to do. And this is just the normal edition. It's great. So anyway, put the game in, start playing it. I got this Saturday and we're recording this on Monday. I tried to see if I could finish the game by today. But it's fairly long.
It's a longish campaign.
So I'm very close to the end. I'm on the I'm on like 3 levels left, basically.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm on the story wise. So spoilers, if you think you can be spoiled for Doom, they fight aliens.
They're not aliens. They are demons from hell that invade Mars and Hermoods.
Sorry. Yes.
It's
in space, but they're not aliens.
Yes,
I get that. Okay. Yeah. I'm on the basically second trip to hell. Which, I love hell. Hell is a great place to do. Hell is
all the card keys become skulls, and that's really cool.
It's awesome. So I'm there. So I'm pretty deep in. I've my opinions are formed, and I don't think they're going to go up or down one way or the other.
Yeah, no, I can confirm having beaten the game. The game does not get bad at the end. The game just gets more awesome at the end.
I don't know how it could get bad. It's such a firm foundation.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have been blown the fuck away by this game. So, I mean... I history, I guess. You've talked before. You played Doom and Doom 2, and you love those games.
Yes.
I have no real history with Doom. Obviously, I think anyone who is a gamer knows Doom. It's like, yeah, it's just in your DNA.
It's the granddaddy of first-person shooters.
Yeah, so like, I've seen a lot of Doom. I've heard the soundtrack. I know the enemies and stuff like that. And I've played some of it. I've just never sat down and like, I'm going to play all of Doom today. I've never done that. So going into this, like, I bought this because you said it was really good.
Basically. It's so good.
And it's kind of funny because it got good critical reception, but it wasn't quite as like strong out there as what you were telling me.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, okay, I got to play this. And again, I don't even play first-person shooters much anymore because there's not a lot of great ones out there anymore.
Yeah.
So got Doom, started playing it. Like, from moment one, this game is so inspired.
God.
It is visually just masterful. It is one of the most gorgeous games of this generation so far. Maybe gorgeous is the wrong word. Visually stunning.
Yeah.
It's often very intentionally not gorgeous.
Yeah, definitely.
It's ugly and bloody and grim, but not in like an ugly, gritty Call of Duty way or anything. It looks like Doom made in 2016. And it's got these incredible environments that you move through. It's got unbelievably good combat. The guns and the gun balance and what you have and the enemy types and the way they gradually add in these new enemies and build it up and up and up. And, you know, there are combat arenas that are almost like puzzles, just figuring out what gun do I use in what spot at what second so I can fucking survive this damn thing. It's like that. But then there's also exploration. And I could totally tell you could spend a month with this game, spend a couple of days on every level and just kind of wallow in it, and you would have so much fun because every level, like, you know, a classic Halo game by Bungie, is just so,
or like old school Doom,
is just so in depth and so fully fleshed out and developed. It's so fun to play. And while the story is not like the main thing to talk about with this game, it's really good. Like, for what it is, it's very funny, and it is very self-aware of the conventions that Doom invented and the conventions that have come since Doom was released.
Yeah.
And I think it's very interesting how it plays with all of that, but while telling a good story on its own that has a certain amount of intrigue that moves you from place to place without it feeling like a series of fetch quests or something. It never feels like you're going somewhere just for obligatory reasons.
Yeah.
Even though you are, you're getting the fucking different colored keys. It's amazing how well they kind of hide that within the story. But it also does that without an excessive amount of narration. It's very Valve-esque in that there's no cutscenes. It's just people talking to you while you play, that kind of thing. It's got such an imaginative world. Every level is so different from the one that came before. You know, so you might have two that are in the same overall, like, Argent facility, but you're in very different kind of locations.
Yeah.
So it almost feels like it's taken that, you know, and again, my point of, like, reference for this kind of stuff is Halo in terms of really good first-person shooter design. But the thing Halo Combat Evolved taught us all about how you design a campaign is that you change things up before you're allowed to get bored of it.
Yeah.
Doom took that to, like, the fucking extreme.
Yeah.
You go to hell in, I think, level 4 or something?
I think it's, like, level 5 or 6.
Level 5 or 6. And I was like, I'm not anywhere near bored of where we are so far, but sure, I'll go to hell if you want me to, and this is awesome. So, like, before anything can get stale, they're throwing new shit at you. And you're constantly getting new guns, and it's this incredible upgrade system. Just, this is such a polished, unbelievably good game. This has been a crazy year for games. It's been so good, and this is another one where I'm like, I don't know how I make a top 10 this year. I don't know how I rank like this against Uncharted 4. They're both basically perfect at what they're trying to do, and what they're trying to do is so specific and interesting and unlike anything anyone else on the market is doing. This is easily the best first-person shooter I've played since Bioshock Infinite, and in terms of campaign, might have to go back further. Bioshock Infinite is very special because of its story and its atmosphere and its world, but on a pure like gameplay level, Doom blows everything out of the water just for years back. You know?
Yeah. I think I know you didn't play this game, but the only thing in recent memory that gives it any competition is Wolfenstein: The New Order, which is also...
And that's what I tried to get into and couldn't.
Yeah,
and
it's a very different kind of game than Doom.
Yeah, but I'm just amazed. I'm sure that Wolfenstein game is good.
It's very good,
but it's funny to me how I couldn't get into that, and this one hooked me immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, because the Wolfenstein The New Order has like an interesting sort of like pseudo-stealth focus on it, especially early on. But what's most interesting to me is that like both Doom and Wolfenstein The New Order are these two classic id franchises that like Wolfenstein 3D is like literally the first-person shooter. And then like for them to come out with a game in, I guess that was 2014, that was like, and that was developed by Machine Games, it wasn't developed by id themselves. But for that to come out and to be like, oh, this is an amazing fucking game, and it's this weird, like, pseudo like alternate history thing set in the 60s and all this crazy stuff. Like Wolfenstein the New Order is really awesome. And then for like 2 years later, the other id franchise that's not Quake, Doom, comes out and it's the new Doom game. And it's like, holy shit, this is awesome. But this is like awesome in a level that like, I think Wolfenstein the New Order is a really, really good game. I think this new Doom game is a great game. Like this game is fucking amazing. As like as an exhibit of just like pure raw game design, like it is unparalleled, I think, for years, basically, in terms of the combat design and the level design and the upgrade system and the weapons and all that and how all that stuff interacts. It's like so insanely perfect. I have no idea how they made this game. Like it's completely insane to me.
It is awe-inspiring. Sometimes it's tough to take that step back and think about, okay, this is something people had to sit down and make.
Yeah.
Because you're so wrapped up in it when you're playing it. But you look at any of those encounters or those moments and you're like, it is mind-boggling how effective this is and how well built every moment of this is. And just little things like that upgrade tree, for lack of a better term, where each of your weapons has two add-ons, and those add-ons have upgrades, and then your overall Praetor suit has some upgrades.
And you have the runes, and those you can upgrade.
And so it's actually a fairly small number of upgrades, especially compared to other shooters with RPG elements.
Yeah.
It's fairly small. It's not like you're constantly going into your menu and changing things. But it adds, every time you do it, it's like adds this tangible effect to your gameplay.
Yeah.
And like the runes are really impressive because they are directly tailored to how you play. Because if you get a rune, you add it. Upgrading it is based purely on how you play with it.
Yeah.
So if you get like, the one that is you do a glory kill, which we'll have to talk about. Yeah. And then if you do a glory kill, you get a boost of speed. Yeah, and then if you have, while you're having your boost of speed, if you get kills with that, it'll go towards upgrading it. That kind of stuff is so smart because it literally is listening to how you play.
Yeah.
And so even though this is a game that is not conventionally open-ended in the way we think of that, it is very open to all kinds of play styles in a certain way and how you go through this and how you specifically interact with the sandbox they've given you of tools, which is very deep. I mean, one of the things I'm most amazed about is I've finally completed my weapon wheel and I have the BFG. So
yeah.
I think that's every weapon.
Yeah, that's every weapon. And I love that they give you, like, you get everything you need a couple of levels before the end of the game. So you have, like, a good two or three levels where you literally have everything. Like, every rune, like, if you've been getting weapon upgrades and everything, like, on the armor chips and all that stuff, you are fully upgraded before the last level of the game. And I love that. That's like, you have that's how I played the game, is that if I had missed a couple of secrets or something, I would just replay the level to get them again, like right there.
Okay.
Before moving on. So when I got to the last level, I had everything and I was like completely suited up and I was ready to fucking kill the shit out of some motherfucking demons, which is the way you want to feel while you're playing Doom.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but I have everything and I'm amazed by, there are encounters where I'm not using every gun, but I'm using an awful lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, I will switch to, okay, I need my combat shotgun right now because I've got the add-on where I do basically, it's like a grenade throw.
Yeah.
And that's really useful for this kind of enemy. But now there's a bunch of the little guys, and I'm going to get up close and pull out the super shotgun because I'm just going to tear them apart. But then, you know what, there's these kind of heavies, and I don't want to go up close and personal with a shotgun on that. So I'm going to use my plasma gun because my plasma gun has the heat release.
Yeah.
So if someone small comes up on me, I just release the heat and kill them. But then, oh God, there's three of the giant fat guys.
Mancubuses.
And now that's when I pulled the BFG out. And so it's just like, you're constantly changing. And like, if you play it at a certain difficulty level where it gets hard enough, you're going to die and you're going to have to try each of these encounters a few times. And each time it's like, I add on. It's like, okay, I know what to do here, but my missing piece is over here. Okay, this is where I pulled the chainsaw out. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And there's so many tools at your disposal. And it is constantly inviting you to use as much as you want to use. It is not restrictive in any way on those things.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me because this is something where, you know, like, just like to say it, because if people, like, don't know about Doom, they maybe just assume that most first-person shooters today have the two-weapon limit thing that sort of Halo more or less started. Like, Doom does not have that. It is from the tradition of old-school PC shooters where you have every weapon you pick up, and when you pick up a weapon, it's just added to your arsenal and you switch it all the time. And I think this might be the only game that has that system where I feel like I am using basically every weapon. I don't never use the pistol that much past like when like ammo was not a big concern anymore.
Right.
But other than the starting pistol, which is your infinite ammo weapon, so it's not designed to be something you use all the time. Other than that, for the entire game, I used every single weapon. Like, in some of, like, the, when you get to the last level where it's like, there are some of those fucking fights are just insane what they expect you to deal with. I am literally using every single weapon in a fight. Like, I am, because you need, because it's like, your ammo's your concern, and your different weapon mods, like, configure well with different enemies and stuff. And so it's like, well, I need to use my rocket launcher here, and like, oh god, I'm out of rocket ammo. I don't want to chainsaw these guys. I want to save my chainsaw for someone else. Okay, then I'm going to switch to my plasma rifle and do this. And like, you are using everything at your disposal all the time. And like a game like the original Doom, I basically used the shotgun almost constantly, and then like occasionally I would switch to something different if it was a harder enemy, but it was like shotgun all the time basically in the original Doom. Or like Half-Life 1 was like MP5 and the shotgun in that game, and that's like all the time. Same thing with Half-Life 2. It's like, once you get the shotgun in Half-Life 2, I basically only use the shotgun and sometimes the pulse rifle. And that's like, and all those other styles of first-person shooter that use that mechanic, I basically pick like two weapons that I switch between for almost the whole game. In Doom, the super shotgun, once I got it, was my main weapon that I like would fall back onto, because the super shotgun's really fucking awesome in this game. But like, there was no fight other than like just like mopping up like small enemies along the way to like a real encounter that I went through only with the super shotgun. Like, that never happened. Like, I would always have to switch to the rocket launcher and to like the Gauss rifle and then to the plasma rifle or something, and like in the chain gun, and like back and forth all the time. Like, it's insane to me that it's like, because this game not only like brings back and resurrects some of those like classic design principles of old first-person shooters that on the PC and stuff that have fallen by the wayside since. It's been a long time since those were regularly used mechanics. And it takes those things, and not only does it use them, it improves upon all of that. Like, even the health system, where it's like, it does not have regenerating health, it uses health packs. But what they do to fix the problem that health packs used to have of you getting into a scenario where you were low on health, and like, you would just play the game very cautiously all the time. So like in the original Doom, if like I had 5 health left and there were no health packs anywhere, that was the part in the game where it's like, well, I'm going to stand really far away and shoot stuff with my rocket launcher and not get in the mix. And that's a really boring way to play the game. Doom fixes that by having the glory kill system that makes it so that like, basically if you knock enemies into a state of low health, that you can do an execution kind of style kill on them. That's a really quick animation you can do, that when you do that, they drop extra health. And so the enemies become health packs for you.
This was the thing that first, when I first realized, oh, this is a smart fucking game.
Yeah.
That's when I really got it, because what it forces you to do, and this is something so few first-person shooters do, and yet this kind of first-person shooter should be making you do it, is it makes you aggressive.
Yeah.
This is a classic shooter with no cover, constant movement, that kind of thing. But as you say, if you had just health packs and nothing else, you would be scared to be aggressive.
Yeah.
But it wants you to be aggressive. So if you are low on health, you have no other options. You need to go out there and fuck some motherfuckers up.
Yeah.
And get the health out of them. And it's a high-risk, high-reward proposition, but it really makes you play the game the way it should be played.
Yeah.
And gets you really into the mechanics. And right off the bat, too, it's really smart about introducing you to everything without anything in the way of formal tutorials.
Yeah. Yeah, no, like, it's... like, this game is a master at encouraging and incentivizing the player to play the game in the optimal way. And, like, the way that it's designed to be played the best. And that's something that, like, on our Uncharted podcast, I think we talked about a lot, that the Uncharted... one of the main issues with the Uncharted combat is that it's very bad at teaching the player and incentivizing the player to play in the most fun way, which is to be very reckless, which is to run out into combat and use, like, blind fire and stuff like that a lot, and throw grenades and jump all over the place and use the melee. And it's like, while that is the most fun way to play with the Uncharted games combat, and they got better at like fleshing out the systems along the way, until Uncharted 4, they were never good at like that sort of teaching the player that that's what you wanted to do. And so like how I played the Uncharted games the first time around, and how you played it, how like most people play Uncharted combat, was you just stick behind a piece of cover, pop your head up and shoot into the enemy in the head, and then pop back down before you take too much damage, because that's how most cover shooters are played. And so like, what Doom does is it looks at like that kind of problem that lots of games have, and it just says, well, what can we do to tell the player, hey, use this weapon mod with this weapon, and this is how to do it. And it's like, well, like, let's put this upgrade system that works by you using the upgrades, and that like using the upgrade effectively in a specific way that like is a sort of challenge is what can like, is what teaches the players, like, okay, like this is a weapon that I can use to like I can use the Gauss cannon to kill like three enemies in a row if I have them lined up right. And it forces you to use the weapon in that way to unlock the ultimate upgrade. So it forces you to think about how to use that weapon that way. And each level has a set of three challenges. And a lot of times it'll be a challenge that's sort of like saying, okay, like trying to get like a death from above glory kill or something on this kind of enemy type, like a Baron of Hell has one of them has like, get a death from above glory kill on a Baron of Hell. That's basically the strongest enemy type that's not a boss in the game. And when they do that, it sort of forces you to rethink your tactics and sort of come up with a more interesting strategy about how am I going to fucking, not only do I have to just like take the down to this Baron of Hell without just blowing him up, I need to like take him down into a glory kill state next to a ledge that I can jump off of and get this like death from above thing. And by like layering all these different challenge systems in with the different upgrades, with the rooms, with the level specific ones, and then layering it into the combat with the glory kill mechanic and the health regaining mechanic, this game is just so masterful at teaching you how to play it organically through playing the game and not sitting down and tell you just like, this game's more fun if you play aggressively. It's like they don't like try to tutorialize it in any obvious way. It's just like the game is designed in such a way that any player is almost inevitably going to naturally play it in an aggressive, interesting, dynamic style of engaging with the combat instead of trying to be stiff and static, and you're like really incentivized to run around and use all the powers that are available to you at the moment.
Absolutely. It is a supremely confident game.
Yeah.
And confidence is one of those things in any form of art that you know it when you see it. You don't think about the lack of confidence a lot when it's not there, but when it's there and it's really palpable, it makes all the difference in the world. Like, this game knows what it wants to be, how it wants to be it, and how it wants you to interact with it. And it doesn't ever have to come out and say that. It is just imbued with that confidence. And because of that, it is such a just a supreme pleasure to play. I mean, and I also was thinking about this the other night because I was enjoying the game so much. And it's everything about it is so good. And I was not looking forward to it before it came out. And that was primarily because I saw like the E3 thing from last year where Bethesda showed it off.
Yeah.
And I'd seen some of the marketing. I played some of the multiplayer beta. And nothing had me at all interested in it. Yeah. It just kind of looked like a big, dumb, violent shooter.
Yeah, I was the same way before it came out.
And I wonder, like, for the people... And I don't think it's because the people marketing this did a bad job. I think this is a supremely difficult game to market.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, how do you convey what this is without sitting down and playing it? Like, it's so tough. And so on the surface, and I think if someone's listening who hasn't played the game yet, I can totally say, okay, it looks like a stupid, you know, big, dumb, frat boy shooter kind of thing, right? And it's not. I mean, it is. It's got some sophomoric humor to it and stuff. But it is a very, very smart game in how it is built and how it wants you to play it. It works out, I feel like, your brain and your instincts. Like, it is one of those games that when I'm playing it, I am fully concentrated on. Like, you know, sometimes when I play a game, I have my dog with me and she'll be, you know, sitting there running around or whatever. And usually I have to keep one eye on the dog because I don't want her to go, you know, I don't know, drink out of the toilet or something, you know. And so maybe I'll be like throwing a ball to the dog or something while I'm playing. And that's great when I'm playing like Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth.
Yeah, yeah.
I can even do that during parts of Uncharted because if it's not a combat portion, whatever. I can have Nate stand there and talk to Sully for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it'll probably just be funny, if anything, because dialogue will pop up. But with Doom, no. If the dog needs me, I have to turn Doom off because there's no way I can split my attention in the slightest. It's just like, it's completely, you are drawn into it. And I guess I would segue into the next thing. My first reaction after my first night of play with this game, which was like, I finished the first two levels or so.
Yeah, yeah.
Is I realized like I was done playing and I sat down at my computer and I just brought up Pokemon Crystal, which I talked about earlier, and played a little of that because I needed to decompress.
Yeah,
I was like breathing heavily.
Yeah, like I was like shivering after finished the game is I played probably like the last like 4 or 5 levels basically all in one sitting, and that game gets fucking hard at the end. And when I finally beat it, and it was like I had gotten every secret and everything, I was like, I just dropped the controller and my hands were shaking. It's like, holy fucking shit, that was a video game.
And every little encounter is like that, basically. It's like that as a microcosm where you'll get through one of these encounters. And by encounter, I mean those moments where you'll be usually kind of a big circular arena in some way. The arenas are all very different, but they're all kind of have the same ethos to them. And you finish one of those, which often takes a lot of trial and error. And it's just, you're not breathing, you exhale. It's like, I did it. Yeah. And like sometimes I'll just go like, you know, like that kind of thing where you just have to let out energy and you're shaking. And it is this like physical thing where it affects you. I can't immediately think of another game that has ever done that to me in that way.
Yeah, like, it's been a long time since I've played a game like that. And, like, where, like, Doom, at its most intense, like, the sign of it being, like, a really great game that, like you just get completely absorbed in having to play the combat is that, like, especially near the end with some of those levels that are, like, those combat encounters in the last level are, like, fucking just insane what they expect you to deal with. And one of the great things about the combat design, and this, like, comes from the Doom era of shooters, is that the enemies do not shoot hitscan weapons, which, like, a hitscan weapon is a weapon that strikes the target the second it's shot, and it's what, like, a Call of Duty game, every weapon is just a hitscan weapon. It's, like, or, like, in Halo, it's very easy to tell that the human weapons are all hitscan, so, like, the battle rifle hits its target, strikes its target the second you pull the trigger, and, like, that's how mathematically it works in the game, whereas, like, a plasma rifle or plasma pistol is not, and that's very easy to tell the difference. In Doom, every enemy uses non-hitscan weapons. So, like, that means that every shot that an enemy fires at you, every projectile, is dodgeable. Like, and you have such a high movement speed, and they give you a lot of vertical movement this time around with, like, double jumps and stuff that obviously was not in the original Doom, that, like, a huge part of the combat is you dodging enemy projectiles and then, returning fire. And a lot of times, with the shotgun being such a powerful weapon that you get lots of ammo for, it's a lot of, like, sort of, like, ducking around enemy attacks and, like, going into an optimum range and firing your shotgun at point-blank range and, like, jumping back out. And it's such really active, dynamic combat where there's, like, you are not ducking behind cover. That is not how that works. You are, the way you survive is by not getting hit, and you have control over not getting hit. And the effect that that had on me in some of those harder fights was, like, an imp would, like, pop out of nowhere and shoot a fireball at me, and I would, like, physically jerk my body as I moved the controller to, like, dodge the attack, because, like, I am so in the flow state of playing the game that it's just, like, I need every extra, like, centimeter to try to dodge this fireball, because if I get hit, I'm gonna die. I have, like, 10 health. And so, even though, like, I know logically that, like, that's not going to do anything, my body just reflexively just, like, jerks to the side for a second when I'm trying to dodge a fireball. And that is something that, like, I haven't done since, like, I played, like, Burnout Paradise or something like that, with the racing game. That's, like, one of the best racing games I've ever played that has that effect of, like, oh shit, that's an oncoming truck. Like, I need to get out of the way. And it's so fast and, like, this really blistering, like, 60 frames per second gameplay that, like, you know you can do what you need to do. And it's, like, you know that, like, I have the power to clear this entire combat encounter without getting hit. Like, I can do that. It's not like a demon can't cheap shot me in such a way that it's completely impossible to dodge. If I get hit at any point, that is a failure on my playing the game. It's not just like Call of Duty, you're going to get hit all the time. And that's why regenerating health is this thing that's like, that makes that not an unfair mechanic. With, like, Doom, there's no leeway. It's like, if I'm getting hit, it's because I'm fucking up, so I'm going to try to not fuck up. And then along the way, I'm going to fuck them up hardcore style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and it makes some of those encounters brutally, brutally difficult. Yeah. There is one that I was playing last night that, no joke, took me an hour and a half to get past this thing.
Yeah, there was, one in the second to last level that, like, I probably had to try like 7 times.
More than 7 for me, but it was the one in the first hell level, and it's near the end.
Yeah,
big circular. It's the first one where you meet, I don't know what they're called, but they're like the witches of Doom, where they, like, send these bolts.
Oh, the summoners.
The summoners. Yeah. And you have the
guys are motherfuckers.
And that one is such a bitch of an encounter, because what happens is after you take out the first summoner, which basically you have to clear everyone else out so just you can get a clear shot at that summoner.
Yeah, because they teleport all around.
Right.
All over
the place. And to take out everyone else also means you have two of the big heavy guys. I forget what they're called.
Mancubuses.
That's interesting. And they're not easy to get down, especially if you don't have your chainsaw.
Yeah.
Or that has no fuel or whatever. And so anyway, you get all of them, you get the summoner done, you're like, I've won. Oh no! And then it summons another summoner and more mancubuses and more of everything else. And at that point, you've used up all the health and the ammo, and you're like, motherfucker! And it's so tough. And that was one where I had been playing on Ultra Violence, which is the highest unlocked difficulty at the start.
It's basically like heroic to use Halo terminology.
Right. So I've been playing on there the whole time to finally beat that one. No, did I? I know I think I might have at the very end, like I think I turned it down to hurt me plenty, beat that one, moved past, and then turned it back up. And then I recently turned it back down again because I also was trying to get through as much of the game as I could before this podcast. Yeah. And it's a game I know I'm going to replay plenty, so I'm like, I'm fine if I do the difficulty later because it's fun. But yeah, it's like, but that one was, I mean, there's moments where, and it's funny because it's other games where I've done that, it's been like an hour and a half on an encounter. I come out hating that game wanting to just kill it. And I didn't come out like happy. Like I was like, now I'm having the best day ever.
Yeah.
It was definitely some frustration. I'm not going to, of course it's frustrating. That thing's going to happen if you have to do this. But it was like, I was frustrated. I'm like, okay. And then I did three more encounters. It's just like, but I didn't like throw the controller down and leave. It's like, I got through it. I'm going to go fuck up some of these demons. And I need to keep playing. And it's like, it incentivizes you to, even if it's really, really tough, it's not, for the most part, bullshit tough.
Yeah, exactly. Because like I said, it's like so on, like you are so empowered as the player.
Yes.
That it's like the game just like isn't like, the game is not designed in such a way that honestly, I don't even think they could make something that would be unfair. You could make something that would be like, ridiculously difficult if they just like spawned in like 20 barons of hell and then the fucking Frankfurt would go to complete shit and everything. But like the game is designed in such a way that it's like you are so empowered as the player and you can do so much damage and you are so mobile that like there are some encounters that like on paper would have been like incredibly difficult, but I was just like in the right mindset and I was just on point for the whole fight that I cleared the entire fight with barely getting hit.
Yes.
And like I came out of it and I was like, oh my god, like I just. And it's just, it's that thing where the game gives you this intense sort of power fantasy element of it, but without ever being easy. Like, because even on the Hurt Me Plenty, that, like, I went to Hurt Me Plenty to find some secrets when I was just sort of, like, didn't want to engage with the game really heavily to find, like a hidden level or something. And so, even on Hurt Me Plenty, though, it's not like you can sleepwalk your way through the game.
No, not at all.
Like, it's still hard. But the power fantasy element is still so there because when you like do succeed, it's just you feel so empowered as the player. And what they managed to do by like sort of very lightly characterizing the Doom Marine with like his animations and everything of just like fucking just like smashing shit that like that's important to the story. And just like whenever something like that fucking Optimus Prime sounding robot dude talks to you, you're just like, oh fuck off, man. I'm here to do one thing, kill these motherfuckers, and I'm gonna do it. And everything, every animation he has, that's all from the first person and everything, it's always like, I am just going to kill some demons. And that's like 100% my purpose. And then especially when you get to hell, you find some of the like audio logs in hell.
Yes, they're so great.
That's this demonic voice just going like, and then the Doom Slayer came to us and we rued the day that we invited his wrath upon our heads. And you find out what the demons think of you, that like, you are this dude who like 20 years ago or however long it was that like Doom 1 and Doom 2 happened, like, not only stopped their demonic invasion of the Martian moons, but you went into hell and, like, killed their leaders and, like just, like, wreaked complete havoc on hell and the demons, and they are afraid of you. And when, like, they twist that around and you realize fully that, like, you as the player feels completely justified in feeling like this unstoppable badass motherfucker. Because it's like, that is what you are. That is how the, like, even if you died a bunch in this encounter, like, at the end of the day, you walked into hell, and there were 1,000 demons hanging out in, like, that suburb, and there's no population in that town anymore when you, like, fucking drove out, right? Like, that's the reality of your existence. Like, you come in with a shotgun and a pistol, and everyone else is gone by the end of the day. And that's, there's... And by making them demons, it feels like totally okay because they're hell demons. Like, I'm not going to feel bad about that. I don't have any sympathy for a fucking flying cacodemon monster. I don't give a shit. I will punch his fucking eyeball out because fuck that thing. It's evil.
Yes. The mythologizing in this game of the Doom Marine is just a sublime pleasure.
Yeah.
Like, from the very beginning. I mean, you talked about this a little bit on the podcast
last week.
The
fucking sarcophagus.
I mean, it's, yeah, you are risen from a fucking sarcophagus. The more you learn about that over the course of the game and how that ties into the main story and everything is awesome and hilarious. All those audio logs are fantastic and they're so funny. And then your relationship with Samuel Hayden, who is the aforementioned Optimus Prime sounding guy, who is a brilliant scientist who turned himself into a robot, which I love his whole backstory.
Yeah, and he's like, they're basically mining Argent energy with his energy that they're like sort of siphoning from hell. So it's like they're inviting the demonic invasion upon them.
Yes, and so I love that just every time you're about to get to the conventional part in a first-person shooter where your boss basically tells you what you have to do and why it's important, The first time the Doom Marine just takes the fucking tablet and shoves it against the wall.
Yeah.
The next time it's like, okay, we have to stop the Argent Energy, but I want to save the system, so bash, bash, bash.
And smash it to fucking pieces.
And you have that whole level where Samuel Hayden is like, please, you don't know what you're doing. And you're just crippling the energy production, which probably is the right thing to do because these guys don't know what they're doing. But it's hilarious. It's just like he has the Doom Slayer. He's got his one purpose.
Yeah, and he's going to do it. Totally single-minded. He is like... But what I love about it is that he is like the slasher movie villain for the demons. It's like, it doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter how far they run. It's like he is fucking Jason. He only has one thing on his mind and he's just going to fucking keep on walking. Doesn't matter what you do. Like he wants to kill all the demons and he's just going to keep on going. And you can't stop him. He's just going to keep on coming back and he's just going to kill you in more and more ridiculous ways because he's getting a little bit bored.
And I love when you finally meet Samuel Hayden in person, how completely resigned he is to like, I've got some supplies in my office. Here's what we need to do. You destroyed my energy, but we'll talk about that later. It's like he's completely realized what this guy is. And he's like, let's just finish the job. Yeah. It's hilarious. And it's funny that, you know, I mean, we're going to have to talk about the different ways this approaches shooters in this era. But that is one of the most amazing things is that we've been on this arc of having the silent protagonist, which is originated by things like Wolfenstein and Doom, in a first-person
shooter. Back when you couldn't have anything but a silent protagonist. Right. Like, there wasn't even voice in games really back then.
Absolutely. On to stuff like, you know, the progression of Halo, which starts with kind of a version of that in the Chief, who is more and more characterized until he's talking in the levels in Halo 4.
Yeah, while you play as him.
Right. And that's a cool progression, and I think for things like Halo 4, BioShock Infinite, any of those games to work...
Like the Far Cry games.
You have to do that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that Doom says, no, fuck that, that's not what we are, that's not what we're going to try to be, and they have something so entertaining and interestingly dynamic while being traditional in some way. It's very interesting. Like, because of when it was made... This game, just by employing certain old archetypes, feels totally radical. It's strange. And it is radical in other ways, the way it marries like that modern kind of progression system with a more traditional combat flow.
Yeah.
It's very revolutionary, I think, in how it's mixing those things.
But what I really like about how they handle that silent protagonist stuff is that the way it used to be done, and it was done for a long time, like up through like Half-Life and stuff, was that like... The silent protagonist was not just a silent protagonist, but a featureless protagonist. That's like, you played Gordon Freeman in Half-Life and Half-Life 2, and he was a theoretical physicist that worked at Black Mesa, and they were doing experiments, and it went wrong. But, like, Gordon Freeman isn't a character. And, in fact, that's one of the weakest parts in Half-Life 2 near the end, is that they tried to sort of, like... I think his name's Scott Breen, like, it's the human administrator that the Combine have at the end of Half-Life 2. So there's, like, this sort of, like, weird one-off line that's kind of lampshades one of the game's narrative issues, where he's like, Gordon Freeman, like, who are you? What are you doing? Like, you think you're a creator. You don't create anything. All you do is destroy. And it's sort of, like, trying to, like, paint, like, make you think of Gordon Freeman in another light. But it's like, Gordon Freeman is never characterized. And even, like, the characters around him in Half-Life 2, like Alex Vance, have smart writing and great performances, and it's a strong feature of that game. But her reactions to Gordon Freeman and stuff never make Gordon Freeman have any sort of personality. Like, he is a silent protagonist and a featureless protagonist, and those games are designed in that way, and it's fine. But what Doom does is so smartly is that nowadays, I think we just don't expect that and we don't want that anymore in the way that most first-person shooters deal with it. Like, Far Cry 3 dealt with it, Halo 4 dealt with it. Like, there was a whole generation of shooters that have started, like, in 2012 that started really doing this, where you have your first-person shooter protagonist not only have character, but they are talking, and they're talking while they are playing. And it was like, and that used to be like a big faux pas. That was like, you don't want to break down that, like, Avatar feel of, like, where I'm immersing myself in this character, this character is representative of me, and so you wouldn't want the character to talk. And they said, fuck that. Like, let's just... It's so hard to tell a story where the protagonist of the story is nothing. Like, you need to have them be a character of some sort. And so that the solution to that was just to make them a fully featured character, have them have dialogue, and just do all that, have them have character arcs. And that's worked great, like, with BioShock Infinite. And like, you know, the stories in Far Cry 3 and Far Cry 4 aren't amazing, but the aspect of them is well done. What Doom does is it's like, well, we don't want the Doom guy to be talking all the time, because who voices the Doom guy? How does the Doom guy sound like? How do you handle that? That's just a weird idea. But what we can do is he can be a silent character, but he can be a character still. And so what they manage to do is how people react to you, the actions that the Doom Marine takes in the environment with, like, hitting the buttons and stuff, those animations have personality to them. And finding some of those audio logs, like in Hell, that comment directly on the Doom Slayer creates a character and a persona for the Doom Marine that the player is invited to inhabit instead of the player just supposed to fill him up as a vessel. Because in that way, the game designers can't expect what the player is going to bring to the character in that way and can't design their game to sort of account for that. Whereas they, like, create this persona and invite the player to inhabit him, and that persona is this unstoppable juggernaut that is going to just destroy everything in his path, and that is this incredible power fantasy that is encouraged by the gameplay. And so that's, like, the huge difference between this Doom and the original Doom in terms of the storytelling stuff, is that, like, the Doom guy in Doom 1 was nothing. The Doom guy here, I feel like I could write a small essay on him and, like, who he is and, like, his personality and his narrative function in the story. And that's amazing, because he never utters a single word.
No, there is so much personality and color and life to everything in this game. Like, the actual narrative thread with the Samuel Hayden and Olivia, whatever her name is, the kind of villain, it's thin by certain standards, but it's actually very fleshed out if you look at it. And the whole world is so fleshed out. Like, I haven't taken the time to read every Codex entry I've gotten, but when I've read them, I've enjoyed them immensely, and it's clear so much thought went into every little detail in this thing.
Yeah.
And it makes such a difference, because even if a, you know, big complex story isn't being told, I'm getting way more of what I consider to be kind of artistic narrative worth out of this than many recent games that sort of try to do way more than that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and, like, some of the codec entries and stuff, the text things you find, there is this really fun other, like, sort of background setting element of the story that is, like, this really weird sort of, like, satire of corporate culture, where, like, this whole business that has built its foundation upon going to hell and stealing hell energy, and, like, the weird corporate interface with demons and stuff, where it's, like, sort of reflects back on the way that, like, corporations cannibalize their own employees. Like, in this case, it's sort of, like, literally. And there are some moments that, like, are, like, really subtly, incredibly funny, and the one that stuck out to me the most is in near one of the last levels. I think you probably would have played through it by now. There's that hologram dude that, like, pops up all the time. This is, like, corporate spokesperson, has, like, that very cliche voice, and he's just constantly talking about stuff that's, like, random corporate stuff, and you usually don't pay attention to him. And over the course of the game, the more and more you see that hologram pop up that's just, like, spouting off random lines to, like, the presumed employee that's in the area, the slowly become more and more insane, where, like, one time he's like, please, if you've, like, blah, 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 then report to Section 2 and discuss this with the White Council. And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then eventually, near one of the last levels, I walked past him, and, like, I didn't register it at first, and, like, was finding a secret, and then I came back to this room, and I realized he was just chanting, like, demonic Latin in that exact same voice as, like, Necronomicon ex mortis val coran shabmakaramar. And it's like, what? Like, he's just speaking, like, demon language now. It's in, like, but in that exact same tone of voice. And, like, I had to pause the game because I was just laughing so hard at the delivery of it and how subtle it is in the background, because you don't pay attention to it. And it's like, it sounds like gibberish. And in that instance, it, like, is literally just spouting out demonic gibberish at you. It's fucking hilarious.
No, it's a game with so much, as I said, character and color to it. It is so enjoyable to just inhabit this world and have fun with it. And that the game doesn't take itself seriously, but takes everything just seriously enough that it's fun and weighty and just has meat to it all. I love it. Okay, the gore level in this game. It is a beautiful symphony of violence.
Man, yeah.
I mean, I've been trying to think about this because I feel like, obviously, there is something sophomoric about having violence this level.
Yeah.
But there's also the specific way it's implemented, I think, is more interesting and fun than something like Gears of War. I don't know.
Sure,
like, I'm thinking about how this game feels like it belongs in this moment in gaming and feels relevant, whereas I'm looking at everything for Gears of War 4, and that feels like a game that is going to be very out of time when it comes out.
Yeah.
What's the difference, would you say?
I think it's the tone thing overall. Because, like, Gears of War is so deadly serious about itself. Like, think back to the fucking Mad World trailer for Gears of War 1. That, for me, yeah. That's, like, the flashpoint for how Gears of War wants to carry itself. And how a lot of the audience at the time, and, like, hey, I was fucking, like, 13 when Gears of War 1 came out. So more like 13 or 14. Like, I thought the Mad World trailer was cool when I first saw it. And now thinking back on this, like, man, that is extremely lame. Like, how lame is that? Because it is, like, Gears of War is a really fun, like, incredibly important and greatly designed game. But at the same time, its tone is that sort of very juvenile, like, taking itself very seriously, 90s comic book style, like, extreme violence and, like, burly, ridiculous male protagonist. And there's, like, one female character, and she's kind of in the background. And the most you really, like, get out of her is the fucking Marcus Fenix going, Anya, all the time. And that's it. And it's like, that's like what those games are. Whereas like Doom, like I said, like it has this corporate satire and this sort of like satire of first person shooter campaigns in general. And it has this like bright, colorful aesthetic. And it just, and the music is just like,
oh, we
it's not
to
trying
that.
To be like somber and stuff like that. It's just like, and it's just like ridiculous fucking, the like most like hyper industrial metal music you could, I don't know where the fuck they dug these people up that, like, did the music for this game, but, like, they deserve,
I think,
all the accolades in the world.
I think they were in sarcophaguses, too.
Yeah, they were entombed in stone sarcophaguses in hell, and in, during the process of this game, they rose them up in some sort of demonic fucking enchantment or something. Because it's like, the music is great, the way the music is incorporated, where, like, it will fade out after a combat encounter, then come back in when you've gone to a next combat encounter. All that stuff is just like there's this life and energy and humor that's like where Doom does not take itself seriously. And that's true of Doom of old as well. Like Doom is like the premise is fucking demons invade Mars for God's sake. Like there is not a self-serious bone in this franchise's body other than Doom 3, which is a game I didn't like very much. So it's like Doom 1 and Doom 2, fucking ridiculous, just insane games. And then this carries in that tradition, but with like the much more... But it's insane in much more fully fleshed out ways because the narrative elements of games are way more fleshed out now than they were in 1993, 1994. And so it has that quality of where it's like, it's okay to have fun with the violence because the game is just having fun with the violence and it's not trying to be like let's like think about violence and let's be like let's like think about violence seriously and like the death of Dom's wife, Maria, while we have this chainsaw on this gun, you know, like right. It's not trying to do that.
There's, you know, I agree. There's a tonal dissonance to Gears of War when you're crying for Dom's dead wife and then you put a chainsaw up a dude's asshole.
Like, yeah.
And that, but that's the kind of, yeah. And that's the kind of thing that works when you're 13 and then later you feel like,
man, that was dumb.
That was dumb. But you look at Doom and I feel like Doom is kind of evergreen because it's just fun and silly.
Yeah.
And those glory kills are indeed glorious. Man. And I have heard some critics say they got tired of them, and I think that's a valid complaint. I get that.
Yeah.
I'm not tired of them.
Yeah, because they're like half a second long.
Yes.
They're not like super elaborate, but there is like the animation quality in Doom is just like top fucking notch.
Even oh, absolutely.
For first person. So it's like, and some of them are, I think my personal favorite is the one you can do on the possessed soldiers where like you knock them down, twist their leg around, and stomp their own head in with their own leg. Like, that one is just ridiculous, but it's also fast. But the best thing about the glory kills, and I did not realize this until maybe the second to last level, or I might not have done it until the very last level, is that you get a set of runes that all enhance the glory kills. And the two ones that are really important is the one that allows you to do the glory kill from far away, and the one that allows you to do the glory kill really fast. And, like, especially that glory kill really fast, like, that one's a huge amount of fun because when you have that one on and you have it fully upgraded, the glory kill animation takes, like, 0.1 second, and it's just, like, this explosion of blood on your screen. But what's the best part about it, though, is when you have both of those equipped and then you get the Berserk power-up that just, like, makes you, like, basically melee kill enemies instantly, it allows you to just leap from like 20 feet away and just grab an imp by his head and rip his head in half in like I said, 0.1 second. And like when you, like that is the only way to use the Berserk power up because you just go Berserk. Like it's insane. And the way that that power up was like kind of useless in the original Doom, here, when you do that, like it's just this, like you're just leaping everywhere, just ripping demons to fucking pieces with your bare hands. And it's insane and it's glorious and it's just like I mean, it is that element where, like, the violence is so over the top that it, like, crosses this line of where, like, it could be juvenile to just being, like, hilarious and, like, actually kind of, like, satisfying on a primal level of the way that, like, you know, like, Tom and Jerry cartoons use violence or something. Like, it's just got that, like, impact and oomph to it, and you just want to fucking... Again, it really helps that they're all demons and you don't kill people during this game.
Right.
Because it's like just being able to like leap across this level and grab this fucking Mancubus motherfucker and just like punch his stomach open and rip out his innards with your bare hands. Just like in this like just insanely over the top of the gratuitous fashion. Just feels so good.
Rip a dude's heart out and choke him with it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Indeed, it's great. I think there's two things that make them just perfect. One is that they are so mechanically integrated, that they are such an... They are not just there for show. They are mechanically very, very important on a number of different levels, and they get more and more integrated the more power-ups you get. So that's great. And two is that it's that satisfaction level, which is that these are very hard encounters. They're very stressful. They're very tense and just big, and you're moving, and you get that little break to just rip a guy's head off. It's satisfying, and it allows you to breathe for a second, and it's like a reward of, like, I'm angry at these guys right now,
because
they won't stop coming,
and
I have a job. I gotta go get the fucking yellow key card.
Yeah.
So I gotta just kill all these guys, keep coming. I'm gonna rip the stomach out and shove it down the throat. And then it's like this weird primal, it just understands that need. How much better would Uncharted 4 be if at some point you could just go to Rafe and just rip his stomach out?
It's just like, and, fuck you, man, and just like rip him in pieces. Yeah.
Absolutely. It would mess up the tone of that game.
It would be insane. Yeah, like, then we'll sit down and talk about ludonarrative dissonance, but yeah.
Indeed. Yes. Yeah, so, I want to talk about the music for a second.
Okay, yeah.
More, because you said it, but I just wanted to expand, like... I don't think the music on its own is like one of the best video game soundtracks
ever.
It's like,
it's not music I would ever listen to outside of the game.
Exactly. But I think in terms of use of music in a game, this is top 10 all time.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
In terms of how well the music is used, and that it is an active part of how you play the game because it signifies things. Like when you kill a really tough enemy and then you're like, are we done? And the music will tell you.
It's like, shut up.
And it's so smooth. Like, there's a lot. This is not like a revolutionary thing the game is doing. This is very common, which is that you have your music signifying combat. Every game does it. Uncharted 4 just recently does this.
Yeah.
But I've never heard it done as smoothly as Doom, where it sounds like the music is actively scoring the encounter you are doing as you are playing it. And so, like, as soon as you're done, it ends, and it's never abrupt. Like, it's just. It doesn't, like, just cut off or anything or fade out.
Yeah.
It knows how to do it, and it'll even kind of build when there's, like, one enemy around. It's just the whole sound design is incredible.
Yeah, and it's something where it's, like, most games, or, like, basically every game has that element to it. But most games, it feels like, okay, now the combat song has played, and then, like, after that, like, the environmental walking around music plays. But with Doom, what they do is, that like... It feels like it is just one continuous song that is just like happens to be written exactly the way you are playing the game. That it's just like, and even stuff like I love the way that the music sort of like ducks down and becomes sort of like techno when you go into your map screen and stuff like that.
Yes.
And then like comes back out. And it's just like the way that music flows from the environmental stuff into the combat stuff, because like each level has like what is basically feels like two long tracks that like build into one another as like you are doing different things, and one's like the quiet music and one's the like shit is going insane music, and it just like the way it cuts between those is so incredibly seamless that it is does feel like it's a different level of that sort of effect that every game has of, you know, like my favorite are the games like Skyrim and stuff that have that, but it's a huge open world game. So sometimes like you're just walking around and then all of a sudden it's just like, burr, 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 and it's like that soft horn theme that Skyrim plays all the time. You're walking in the mountain and all of a sudden you haven't seen anything different, but apparently there's a wolf like 500 feet to your left in a cave that you can't even see that you just triggered. And it just goes bum, ba dum, ba dum, and heavy drums start playing. You're like, what the fuck just happened? You don't have that sort of like incongruity with the music here. It's like the music is always playing the way it needs to be played. That is like when it's quiet and it's building. And then when it's like shit pops off and you like go to a gore nest and rip the gore nest apart. And then it's just like, and then like fucking demons start popping in from everywhere. But then the other thing that the music does, that like the sound design in this game is also just insanely good.
I think this is the first game since Halo 4 to top Halo 4.
Yeah, it's just like the weapon sounds and everything are so meaty. But going back to the glory kills, one thing I love about the Glory Kills is how they integrate with the soundtrack of the sound design of, like, the impact of you, like, because a bunch of the Glory Kills are, like, you punching someone in the face and ripping their arm off and stuff like that. And there's a sound design to the impact of you punching enemies that almost feels like it's a heavy drum beat, and there's a rhythm to it that, especially if you get, like, a series of weak imps and, like, enemies and stuff like that, that you're dropping into Glory Kill state really quickly, and then you're just doing, like Glory Kill after Glory Kill after Glory Kill, and you're just chaining them together really quickly. There is this just incredible rhythm to that where it's just, like, bum, 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 and you, like, rip a dude apart, and then you do, like, transition to another guy, and this guy's like, bum, crap, bow, and then shuck, bum, 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 crap, and you're, like, all these different animations that are playing that have those different impactful drum-like, rhythm-like sound effects to them. And but then also, as you do Glory Kills, there is this, like, high screeching wail that starts building in the back of the soundtrack, and then, like, the longer you do it, like the more prominent it becomes. So it's just like this insane, like, percussive frenzy of just, like, bum bum bum, rip rip, bum 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 bum, and it's like this wail just, and you're just ripping people to fucking shreds, and it's like in the background it sounds like the Alien trailer or something is playing, because you're just like, it's just like if it replicates this effect of you having some sort of blood frenzy. And that's like that quality of that, when I was talking about the Berserk power up with those runes, where you're just doing Glory Kills one after another in like fractions of a second. There's this incredible rhythm to that where it's just like you feel like you are going insane and like just reveling in the violence because of the way that it's incorporating with all the production elements of the game, with the animation and the sound design and the music all just coming together just like perfectly.
Absolutely. It's a big reason why I think it has that physical, like that physiological effect of you get, you know, really into it where you almost like stop breathing.
Yeah.
And then you're allowed to breathe. Like when I go to the gore nest and I rip the heart out and I pull it out and I hear the bada bada bada, like that starts. Yeah. It's like I take a deep breath. I'm like, okay, we're doing this.
Pull out the super shock and it's like, boom, boom.
Yeah. It's like, and you start that and then you're in a certain rhythm with the game. And then when it's done and it exhales, you exhale.
Yeah.
Like, you are completely in sync. Now, the sound design, it's not just good quality. It all sounds great. But the mix and everything is insane. Like, yeah. I've been playing this with my PlayStation surround headphones.
Right, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's almost too much at times. Yeah. Like, it is such a complete audiovisual assault. And we talked about the audio, but the visuals, like, on a technical level, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's running at full 60 frames per second. I've never seen a hiccup in that.
No, yeah, it is fucking solid. Completely smooth.
And it looks really, really great. Like, I think this is the first 60 FPS game of this generation where the visuals also have, like, a really just high resolution to them.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, if you look at other ones like Halo 5, Halo 5 is a great-looking game. It basically looks like Halo 4. Like, it's not a big step
up. Looks like a better-looking Halo 4, but yeah, right. It does not feel like the jump from, like, Halo 3 from Halo 2 or something like that.
No, this feels like a full-on next-gen game, and it happens to be running at 60 frames. It is technically pretty flawless. I've had a couple little glitches where it has crashed on me twice while reloading a checkpoint.
Yeah, it crashed on me once while I was reloading a checkpoint.
Which is scary,
yeah.
But it didn't break anything, so that's okay. And I guess the save, it knows, you know, which levels you've unlocked, so it wouldn't be disastrous. But still, it was a little scary. But other than that, no hiccups. It's amazing.
Also, on, like, the graphics department, like, the environments look great, but I also think they did an outstanding job with the enemy design. Which, like, basically every enemy type, with, like, maybe one or two exceptions, are from Doom 1 and Doom 2. But the way they sort of have, like, fully realized them, it was something where it was, like, one of my favorite parts of playing the first half of the game while they're still introducing new enemies a lot was, like, for someone who's a fan of those first two games being like, oh man, I can't wait to see what a pinky demon looks like in this game, or I can't wait to see what a cacodemon looks like when you find them. And, like, their visual design and, like, the visual design of Hell in general is so in sync with how, like, it felt like they were designing it back in Doom 1 and Doom 2, but, like, it is fully brought to life with, obviously, the full graphical power they have today.
I love the Hell sections. Like, they look like the greatest, like, amusement park ever.
And, like a heavy metal album come to life, yeah.
It's like the amusement park or heavy metal album version of Hell, and it's just so fully realized. Like, I've been playing this and Overwatch at the same time, and a lot of the Overwatch maps are, like, great amusement parks.
Yeah.
Like, that you go through. And between that and this, it's like, I never need to go to an amusement park again, because these games just have it down. It's great. So
yeah, and since you've been to Hell the second time, isn't you've seen the like the Titan map or whatever, where like the you spawn in and you see this massive fucking just like skeleton,
yes,
just stretching into the distance, and you go into its mouth to go into the level. That is like I want a poster that is just the like that. Like, the opening shot of that level, it is, like, such an incredible vista, and it's so what hell should look like. It's in that, like, heavy metal kind of sense. It's perfect.
It is both silly and just completely lovingly created.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, man. Just a brilliant game.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if there's anything more to say about it, but it is, like, it is just a masterfully designed game, and it's a game that, like, I just finished it a couple of days ago with, like, the full platinum and everything, and I still, like, I really want to go in and do just, like, a nightmare run on that thing on the hardest difficulty.
Yeah.
And just fucking get back into it, because the combat is just that good.
No, I mean, I've been rushing, sort of, through the campaign to try to finish as much as I could for this discussion, and I'll probably finish the campaign tomorrow night. And then I really look forward to just going back and just leisurely going through each level and just having fun finding the secrets and stuff, because the ones I've found so far, without going too far out of my way, I guess,
yeah,
have been a lot of fun. And it's great. And I now, you know, and I have the original Doom sitting on my Xbox.
Yeah.
I have to go back and play some of that. It might be fun.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say one other thing about the visuals. I love how much playing this, without having played Doom, original Doom, how much I realized I know of the iconography of Doom.
Yeah, like the enemy designs and stuff like that.
I think it's a real revelation for people who have never played the originals. You realize how much it has permeated gaming and pop culture. Like,
yeah,
the Nether world from Minecraft is just hell from Doom.
That's true.
I never,
yeah,
realized,
yeah,
that. It's got cockademons. It's got little floating heads. It's got, yeah, this almost like, it's like the upside down version of the real world. All that stuff. And it's like, I never really made that connection, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
And you realize that when you go in here, it's like, man, I wish there was a Minecraft where I could rip a dude's head off.
Yeah, that would make Minecraft way more rad.
I've got a sword. Why can't I just stab someone in the face with it?
Yeah, why can't I just, like, rip their fucking face off? God, yeah, damn it.
Anyway,
get some health out of it.
When I need to do a retina scan, I just take the dude's torso and just
just slam it in front of the retina scan. Because he's dead. Who cares? Like, yep, it's fine.
The best part is he breaks the arm off so he can use the fingerprint,
yeah,
scan. Oh, it's great. No, and so just that element of it. Like, if you have never played, you know, any Doom game before, don't worry. This game is,
yeah,
totally inviting to newcomers. If you play it on a lower difficulty, I do think it does a little more in terms of, like, tutorial pop-ups is what I read. So if you really just are not suited to this, you can learn.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I started on Ultraviolence, and there was very little in the way of tutorializing, and I loved it. So,
yeah,
it's just total immersion.
It's a very straightforward game.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure, and I'm just thinking, this year, we're at the end of May.
Yeah.
This has been an insane year. I couldn't make a top 10 yet, but if you asked me to make a top 5, I wouldn't know how to rank it.
Yeah, like Doom has thrown me for such a crazy loop, because, like, I was sort of on the fence of, like, well, if people say the single player is good, I'll probably play it at some point, but I'll wait for it to go on sale. There's no way it's going to be that good.
Yeah.
And then from some, like, game critics and stuff that I really respect and I know have similar feelings on Doom as I do, like, coming out of this game and being like, this game is fucking awesome. If you like Doom, or if you just like playing awesome video games, you have to play this game. And I just, like, and saw some footage of it, and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna fucking play this game right now. I don't want to see any more of it. I just want to play it. And for this game to not only, like, just, like, meet those expectations I had of, like, how some of those critics set me up for it, but then just keep, like, even, like, completely blow it out of the water, where I feel like a lot of critics are, like, underselling,
yes,
like, just how good this game is at what it is doing. That's like, I don't, like, if you ask me right now which I think is better, Doom or Uncharted 4, I don't know what I would say. And that's fucking, I have no, like, because remember, we, like, these games came out, like, back to back. Uncharted, I finished Uncharted 4 like 2 weeks ago, and we talked about it on the podcast coming out. I wrote a review that calls it a fucking masterpiece. It's a deconstruction of this adventure genre. Like, I think Uncharted 4 is an incredible artistic achievement. And then I would, like, Doom wasn't even a game I was expecting to buy when it came out. And then now I'm like, it might actually be better than Uncharted 4.
Yeah, I'm in the same. We've got a couple of games this year that are full-on 10 out of 10s.
Yeah.
Like, real 10 out of 10s, not Grand Theft Auto 5, which,
yeah, yeah,
is hugely flawed but got 10 out of 10 for some reason. Like, this is the real deal. And it's like, it's tough. It's like back, I feel like, in 2013 when we got Bioshock Infinite and The Last of Us in the,
yeah,
span of a few months. And it's like, well, what do you do with those two?
Yeah, that's like just... these are two games that like in their like are like kind of revolutionary in different ways for their own genre. And yeah. It's like, and then Doom and Uncharted 4 feel the exact same way. Like, motherfucker, like these are two all-time games. And it feels like it is making me think back on, I guess it was 2014 was the year where like video games like took a year off almost. And like fucking Middle Earth Shadow of Mordor was like the perennial game of the year candidate that year. And I was like, man, I can't believe that that was only 2 years ago. And then we got like fucking 2015 that had like Bloodborne and Witcher 3 and everything. And then now we've got 2016 and we have Uncharted 4 and Doom within a week of each other. That's fucking nuts.
I think this generation had the slowest start of any gaming generation ever.
Yeah.
But it's found its legs, and its legs are very sturdy. I feel like if you consider the start of this generation, Batman Arkham Knight, which is kind of where I draw the line, because that was like the first one that was really this generation.
Yeah, made for this generation, didn't have like old console versions and was like designed for this. Yeah.
And clearly made use of it too. Yeah. You know? And you go from there on, you have that. Into the Witcher, I guess that came out the same time as The Witcher 3. I forget the
Witcher timeline. 3 was a little like a month earlier.
It was okay. Yeah. Then I would say The Witcher 3,
yeah.
Batman Arkham Knight, that kind of conflux into you know those kinds of things through the end of 2015, which was a year with only a couple of great games, but those great games were really really great. Yeah. And now it's just like this year has been hit after hit after hit, and we haven't even gotten started.
Yeah.
Sean.
Yeah.
We were talking about No Man's Sky earlier. That could be a total game changer if that's as good as it looks. That Final Fantasy 15, yeah. Persona 5.
Persona 5 comes out in the States this year. Like, I'm just going to be like sad when we do our end of the year podcast stuff because it's that like I don't like it feels unfair because all of these games should be the game of the year. Like, presuming Persona 5 is the game that it needs to be. Like, all of these are like incredible games.
Good year,
yeah, really good year. Play Doom. Doom is so good. I'm so happy to say that, you know?
Yes.
Like, this new Doom game made in 2016 is so fucking good. How is this a world we live in? That's just beautiful, man. That's just insane. So yeah, play Doom. It's good. Fuck yeah.